The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. So glad to be with you today. As you know, we are broadcasting here live every week from 2 to 5 p.m., 3 to 5 p.m. on the American Family Radio Network. And yes, this is the place where we examine critical issues, the most important issues of life, ethics, values, and religion, and this basic training for your mind. And I'm glad to be a part, a small part at least, of that process. And really look forward to talking to you today. So let me first of all give you the numbers so you can get a hold of us. This first hour, as you know, is our local footprint. You can, of course, be listening to this. If you're listening to it on podcast, you know, you're probably already aware of the fact you want to get in on the first hour. It is the one hour that we have the kind of local audience that allows you to even get a little more room on the line. So let me give you the local number. It's 1-714-754-4150. But we are, of course, toll-free at 1-800-227-5278. So get on the line with me and let's talk about the things that are of most importance to you. What a busy week I've had as well. Yesterday had a great fun speaking with two out of the three of our STR speakers at a conference called the Truth Is Conference out here locally. It was a youth conference, and boy, it's just great to be in a place where you have so much energy in the room, right? Because this is what happens when you go to youth conferences. Now, look, these are not easy sometimes because we've got to find a way to be passionate and engage issues at a level. And for a guy like me who's, you know, 51 and I often feel like I'm the dad in the room, and Brett Kunkel is always quick to remind me that I am the dad or the grandpa in the room. That's okay. But it's a challenge sometimes. And it makes you think a little bit about the way that we engage anyone in our lives, if it's other fellow Christians or if it's non-believers maybe who are in our life as family members, people we work with. And so I thought, as I came in today, I thought, let's spend the first opening 20 minutes of the first hour talking a little bit about how it is we engage people, the kinds of approach we take, why we feel excited about engaging people, and just maybe to encourage you. Let's face it, I think that those of us who think deeply about these issues, who feel that we are Christian case makers of one stripe or another, if we're interested in even listening to a show like Stand to Reason, it's probably because we feel compelled to do what it is Scripture calls us to do, to make a case for what it is we believe, the hope that we believe we have, that we know we have, in the claims of Christianity. And although, as Paul often says, and as Paul says in Ephesians, you know, not everyone is gifted to be maybe an evangelist or a pastor or a teacher or is called to be one of those three things. But Peter doesn't leave us off the hook when it comes to defending what we believe. All of us are called to be apologists of one stripe or another. And why is it easy for some of us to do it and harder for others? Why is it that there are times when events or opportunities that seem easier or more difficult? What is it that compels us even to begin this process? Let me say that on Friday afternoon, you know, we went out with like probably millions of others in America, and we saw The Avengers, right? This is a movie that was released on Thursday night, and we debated about whether or not we wanted to try to actually see it on its opening night, right? But we're not quite that crazy, and I actually needed to work the next morning. So we went on Friday night. And we saw it, and it's, you know, there's a lot we'll talk about. Maybe we get a chance later on during this broadcast. We'll talk about some things that have already been written about examining the Avengers from kind of a Christian perspective, if that's even appropriate to do. So we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. But what I realized is that this is one of those events that many of us are really excited about. And I mean to tell you, it wouldn't be hard for us, and a lot of people I know, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, and they're already talking about this movie. This is how much they're excited about it. The reviews have been great, and they're posting links to the reviews, and they are motivated to share something they feel very excited about. And I thought to myself, as I usually do when one of these events occurs, why is it we don't feel that way often about the things we believe when it comes to Christianity? Now, I know we say we do. I get that. I mean, I want to be as passionate a follower of Christ as I can be as well. But would you at least agree that there's lots of things that we are excited about and share about online with our friends, over a coffee, at work, that have nothing to do at all with our faith? As a matter of fact, we're probably far quicker to share our excitement about a movie or a new CD or a television show or a game that's about to come up in either the NBA or NFL, whatever it may be, than we are to talk about the things that we ought to be motivated about. It's about, and I think sometimes it's because we've relegated this, and many of us have relegated our beliefs in Christianity to a matter of opinion rather than a distinct truth, objective truth claim. And that's where I think the problem is we sometimes we don't see this thing we're offering for what it really is. It's not just a matter of opinion. It's actually the truth that will save everyone and it'll cure the thing that's killing us. And that's where I think the difference is I don't think sometimes we kind of underestimate the power of what it is we happen to hold, this truth claim we happen to hold. It's far more important than whether or not the Avengers movie was good, yet I'm far less likely to share. Why? I think sometimes for me personally, it's a matter of compassion or lack of compassion. If I stop and think about what it is I believe about God and what it does for people, I think I could be redirected in my passion. In the end, I don't care how good a movie is or how good a football game is or how good a CD may be, it's never as good as the truth of Christianity, because it's the truth of Christianity that saves us. So is it really a matter of my not seeing that fully or not realizing there's direct connection between my compassion and my willingness to share this truth? Now, I just want to, as I get ready to talk to all of you on the phone here, just share a couple of things I've learned as a detective that deal with how it is we interact with one another. There is power in certain forms of interaction. I want to share those with you. The first thing I want to share with you is, number one, the power of compassion. This idea that when I start with people, I'm going to tell you, when I first started as a detective, there were many, many years in which I went to classes and seminars and training programs in which we learned how to control conversations, to control interrogations, to be able to get people to tell you what it is you want them to tell you. Not in terms of influencing unduly their confession, but in terms of helping them to put down the barriers so they'll tell you the truth about what happened. And a lot of it was really about tactics, right? How it is I navigate in a situation in which I'm interrogating somebody. And I did make some progress in that. I can tell you that I became the guy, at least in the generation of officers in which I worked, I was one of the guys in our department that you would go to get a confession. You'd say, but this is an important confession we need here. Go get Jim. He'll come in and he'll come in from, you know, if I'm off duty, he'll call me in, and I would do the interview. But I can tell you that I made the most progress in terms of being able to connect with people in custody and get to the truth of the matter when I stopped thinking about it in terms of what I was going to do on the chessboard in terms of the interview, and started thinking about it in terms of, do I really have a heart for the person who's sitting on the other side of the table? It's when I developed a sense of my own need to be compassionate that things started to really make sense to me. And as a matter of fact, I started to talk to suspects in a way that I thought was actually far more powerful. And one of the things I learned was, the second point I wanted to make, is the power of a meal. If you think about Scripture, some of the most important conversations between God and man were done over a meal, right? And so this is one of the areas I realized that, hey, you know, why there's a certain truth to the power of a meal. For example, I would bet that you probably don't spend a lot of time eating with people you don't like. As a matter of fact, when we choose who it is we're going to go out to dinner with, we make sure we're with people we like. We only want to have a meal with people we care about. As a matter of fact, don't you hate those restaurants where it's a long bench along one side of the wall and tables are only separated by 12 or 18 inches and you sit there across the table from people you care about, but just 18 inches away is another group of people. And you feel like, wow, what I really want is a booth, because I don't want to eat with strangers. And it turns out that eating with people removes them from the stranger category and bonds you in a way that very few other activities can bond you. I very seldom will talk to people in a custody setting that I won't eat with first. Because eating with people is a way that I can learn more about them, let down my guard. As a matter of fact, you know, Brett and I take groups to Utah all the time, young groups of Christian high schoolers who go to Utah to speak with college-aged LDS students at BYU. And one of the things we do is we walk in and we sit down at the food court. And we share a meal. Why do you do that? Because A conversation over a meal is very different than a conversation in the quad or a conversation in the hall. Eating has the power to unite us in a way that's very important. It's not a trick. It's just a truth about how it is we only eat with people who are compassionate toward. And if you want to be compassionate toward people, try getting through a meal without finding some way to connect. It's hard. The third thing I want to talk about is the power of interaction. Because what I've learned as a detective is there are three kinds of communicative interactions between people who are in custody and detectives who are interviewing them. And this probably is true for you, too, if you think back at every time you've ever had a conversation or a discussion with anybody. That first level is just the level of conversation. That's two-directional. It's this exchange of questions and answers in which both people provide information. You provide something, and the other person provides something. And this is the most, I think, trustworthy and engaging form of interaction, of verbal interaction. Because the person is going to have to give up something to you, and you're going to have to give up something to them. It's disarming in both directions. It's two-directional. I very seldom do an interview or a contact with a suspect in custody in which I don't spend a lot of time in conversation, which means I have to be willing to give this person something of myself if I ever expect them to give me something of themselves. So the first thing you start with is conversation. I bet if you think about the times you tried to share your faith, I hope they begin as conversations in which you're willing to disarm yourself as you ask the other person to do the same thing. Now, in addition to that, there's another step in this kind of verbal interaction, isn't there? And that's the step of interview, from conversation to interview. And interviews are simply one-directional questioning, right? You're asking questions. And you're offering a little bit less of yourself in that and asking a little bit more from the person you're interviewing. It's one-directional. But it doesn't have to be harsh. You could be interested in people and interview them. As a matter of fact, later today I'm looking forward to interviewing Doug Powell. Now, I suspect as we're involved in this interview, there'll be a lot of conversation as well, right? Because I've got something I want to share with him, and I'm hoping he'll share some things with us as well. He wrote a great application called The Eyewitness Resurrection, and he's also got a book that is amazing I want to talk to him about. You're going to want to hear about it. But the second step in this is the one-directional question that we call interviewing. But there's another step, I think, and we have to do some of this, of course, with suspects, but you also are going to want to do some of this when dealing with the skeptics in your life who are pushing back against the claims of Christianity, and that is the final step, which is interrogation. Conversation, interview, interrogation. And the difference between interviews and interrogations is in interrogations, is that's when you become pointed and more skeptical about your one-directional questioning. In an interview, I'll question, but at some point, I'm going to have to challenge the answers I'm getting. And now I'm beginning to slip from interviewing into interrogating. And I'm going to have to say, hey, this doesn't make sense. If it's a suspect, I'm going to have to point out the places where I believe he lied or she lied. And now I've moved from interviewing into interrogations. But I think we do this, all three of these, when we're dealing with people who are skeptical of our worldview as well. I want us to begin in conversation. I want us to move toward asking the important questions. And at some point, it's going to be important for us to challenge the kinds of responses we're getting. Now you're moving more toward a mode of communication that I deal with all the time, which is interrogation. So it's the power of compassion, the power of a meal, the power of interaction, and finally, it's the power of good questions. And this is the area where if you haven't, I mean, look, I'm on Greg's show, okay? So forgive me for wanting to support the work of the man who's taught me more about getting engaged in conversations about my faith than anyone else. And I'm sure if you've purchased Tactics, or if you haven't yet, what are you waiting for? We can talk about this all we want, but until you purchase that book, you're not really going to have your hands around the most important form of conversation we can have about our faith. Because there's a big difference between asserting something and asking something. And the kinds of questions we're going to ask are the kinds of questions that Greg does a great job of illustrating and talking about in Tactics. And you know, when you assert something, you're now in a position where you need to defend what it is you've asserted. And this is why, for the most part, I don't do a lot of asserting in interrogations. I'm not looking to make claims that I have to defend. I'm asking the person I'm talking to I'm mining out his claims and then asking him to support or her to support his or her claims. And when I ask good questions, I have the opportunity to learn what it is this person's about, without having to spend time thinking about how it is I'm going to defend my own assertions. So the power of questions is highly underrated. It's really important, and it's an important aspect of what we do. And certainly for me as a detective, this is perhaps the most important thing I do, is ask the good questions. Because in the end, if the person I'm talking to isn't telling me the truth, they will begin to give me responses that are contradictory. And if the person that you're talking to is holding on to a worldview that is not really well-reasoned, at some point they will make statements that don't comport with one another. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for those opportunities to share the truth with people and think and hear carefully what it is they're saying to us. So I hope as we begin this conversation together, you and I, over the next 3 hours, and as you actually work with the people in your life that have questions about what it is you'll believe, you'll remember the power of compassion, of meals, interaction, and of questions. Okay, so that's my little opening for you today. I hope it gives you something to think about. And of course, if you listen to this show regularly, you don't need me to even bring that kind of thing up, because you've already thought about this as you listen to Greg over the years. I know I have as well. Listen, before we go to a break here, I wanted to just remind you of something. I got a chance to hang out with Greg a couple of weeks ago in Dallas, and we were sitting having coffee after an event with Frank Turek. And I got a chance, you know, I've always wanted to go. Years ago, I really wanted to go to the very first CIA training program, which was offered usually in the summer. And it's always offered on the East Coast. And I just could not find a way in my schedule. But if you're somebody who's thinking seriously about how to engage the very principles I just got done talking about, those ideas and how it is we're going to interact with the world around us, I can think of very few other courses that in a short period of a few days could do more for you than the Cross-Examine Instructor Academy. Now, you can find that by going to Frank's website, which is crossexamined.org. But he every year assembles a group of good thinkers and speakers who can help train up those of us who already get it. We already have a sense of the importance of apologetics, and we're already engaged in that process. But we just need somebody to help us figure out how to fine-tune and learn how to present the materials clearly, especially in a large group setting, right, like presentations and conferences. And so he's assembled this year another great staff. He's got himself, of course, and Greg and Brett from our organization here, Stand to Reason, will be there. And he's got several other great teachers like Richard Howe and Larry Blythe and Ted Wright will be there as well. And I don't think you want to miss it. If you're somebody who's thinking, how do I engage the world around us? And I've always wanted to be more engaged in apologetics. I want to be more involved in apologetics. This is the place I think you want to be. And they've really changed the curriculum, I noticed this year, pretty significantly. I think what they're basically doing is saying, hey, you know, if you've been here before and you want to even go another step, this is now open to do that as well. So if you've never trained yourself classically or trained yourself in how it is to present these ideas to other people, this is a great place to be. So get online at crossexamined.org, crossexamined.org, and you can see all the information there. In the sidebar, you'll see the Instructor Academy. Hit that link and you'll be able to learn more about that. We'll take a break and come back right after this break to the phone calls, which are already stacking up online. Looking forward to talking to Jim and Dave, and we'll do that right in about 2 minutes here on Stand to Reason.
Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that we are all ambassadors for Christ. This verse has guided STR's mission from the beginning, helping you and other Christians to grow as ambassadors for Christ. And it's why we created a new series of booklets called The Ambassador's Guide. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. Our newest release in this timely series is on the subject of Islam. Written by STR speaker Alan Schliemann, this booklet is a vital resource to prepare you with the knowledge and wisdom to better understand the Muslim faith while sharing Christ in an effective manner, a skill that will be especially valuable in the changing world at our doorsteps. Other topics in the series include the New Atheists and Postmodernism, with other subjects coming out this year. To order your copy of The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, or any title in the Ambassador's Guide series, call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or order online at str.org.
What kind of faith are you passing on to your young people? Is it blind and irrational, or is it reasonable? This is Brett Kunkel, and in this month's Bulletproof Podcast, I'll discuss the biblical view of faith young believers need to hear from us. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android Market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Oh, this is pretty cool. Actually, you're listening to the music of Doug Powell, who will be on our show later a couple of hours from now, in our last hour of this show. And Doug's an artist in a number of ways, both a graphic artist, he's a musician. And what's kind of cool about Doug is he's found a way, I'm going to talk a little bit about this, to kind of redeem and integrate his Christian worldview and the art forms that he's classically involved in. So we'll talk more about that in our third hour. Please stay tuned for that. And I, of course, you know, I identified Tim in Japan as Jim. So, Tim, I apologize. We'll go to you first here. This is Tim in Japan. How are you, Tim?
I'm fine.
Good to have you here today, sir. I'm glad to talk to you today. Tell me about you're calling about theistic evolution and about methodological naturalism. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, I listened to Greg's interview with Fuzz Rana last week, and I thought it was really great and everything. But there was a couple of points that I thought are really relevant to this issue that weren't discussed, and I thought it'd be kind of interesting to run them by you and see what you think of them too.
Yeah, no. You and I actually have had some interaction before, because when you see somebody from Japan, you have a tendency to think, okay, this is unusual, even for me. Please convince me, the website that I run. So it was nice to hear from you last week. So I'm looking forward to, and you're actually affiliated with Reasons to Believe yourself, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So give me your kind of view of methodological naturalism and how it impacts science.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a slippery term. It's in one sense, it's a little bit like the term evolution itself. It depends on what you mean by that. And so the main point I think that is really important to insist on is that we realize that there's two fundamentally different kinds of science. And for now, when it comes to ordinary science, which is, like that you go into a lab and do an experiment, then you can go and repeat the experiment. And, these are things that are amenable to the scientific method. We call it empirical science. In that case, methodological naturalism is absolutely necessary. In other words, you don't go into the lab thinking that I'll get the chemistry will work differently, or the laws of physics will work differently, because some spiritual power is moving it or whatever.
Right.
That was the kind of the ancient worldview where they believed that that natural phenomena worked according to the whims of the gods or whatever. And so in that sense, methodological naturalism is absolutely necessary for that kind of science to even work.
Right. Right. But, makes sense.
But when it comes to origins, we could call it historical science or origin science, whatever. In other words, things that occurred in the past that are unique, you cannot go back and redo the experiment, so to speak. There, you have to be open to the possibility of natural processes or some sort of supernatural intervention. And if you insist on naturalism only, then it becomes philosophical naturalism and not methodological naturalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that point, I think it needs to be really emphasized, because we end up kind of talking past each other. When you're just saying, science must be based on methodological naturalism. Well, it depends on what you mean by science.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, because I deal with this a lot when dealing with investigations, and I've had people write to me and say, well, look, Jim, if you're working an old case from 30 years ago and you're trying to figure out what happened, I mean, you're not going to default to some form of supernatural explanation when you're trying to figure out who your suspect is. You're going to assume as your default position that the killer involved in your case is a real person. who is a material agent, who is working in the universe, working in the realm of your crime, who is responsible for this. You're not going to get to a place where you go, you know what, it sounds to me like a ghost did it, or it sounds to me like a demon did it, or it sounds to me like, you know, you see what I'm saying? They're gonna, they've challenged me to say, hey, Jim, isn't it true even in your own work that you are a naturalist in the way you approach even looking at an event in the past, even though it's only 30 years ago, not 2,000 years ago. And, of course, the difference for me is that no one in my cases is making supernatural claims about something that happened. And that's really what we're looking at here. In this event in history, we've got what I think is a very early record from history, the Gospels, because I believe they are written early. And we're looking at that, and these claims, the claims of the gospel writers, the people who said they were eyewitnesses of the events themselves, are that supernatural things occurred. So like any other claim of an eyewitness, I'm going to have to examine it and see, is that reasonable? And I try personally to avoid talking about there are things that the sciences can help me do in assessing certain types of evidence that I might have in a case. So there are times when I have used the sciences to identify DNA, to do other things to look at whether or not this is blood on this surface, or whether this is, you know, what this chemical might be. Is this the same kind of chemical here that it is over here? So I have used sciences to help my cases. But science doesn't really drive my cases. And if I tell you my cases, for the most part, have been completely circumstantial cases that haven't really been helped much by DNA evidence. I've had the luck. I wish sometimes they would be helped by DNA evidence, but they haven't been so far. So I have to make a case a different way. And so I think that it's a little bit different. I for the most part, Tim, don't spend a lot of time talking about how science can be used to examine an event from the past, because I know in my own practical work that I do that all the time without relying heavily on the sciences. And if, when I do rely on the sciences, it's only to kind of firm up the peripheral things. In the end, it's going to come down to a circumstantial case. And, of course, it's a cumulative circumstantial case. And I think that is appropriate when examining events in the distant past. I don't think that every investigation of an event in the distant past is going to be driven by sciences. It's going to be driven by the best and most reasonable inference from the evidences I collect. And many of those evidences, Tim, are not scientific evidences. Does that make sense?
Sure. And when it comes to historical analysis of, in ordinary history, that you're definitely in that category. But if you talk about the history of life and stuff, it's really the same thing, except that, I mean, you do have, empirical science that you can do, in other words, do experiments on how processes work and a few things like this, but you can't actually go back to the event itself.
Right, right.
And so, therefore, it's historical science. It's not empirical science. And unless that distinction is insisted upon, you kind of talk past each other.
No, I think you're right. Now, so the question becomes, this is one of those things I think is about a communicating an idea, Tim. And here you are working for RTB as an apologist, and you know that the important thing here is not just grabbing the concept. It's about trying to communicate the concept to people who are maybe listening, who really are now used to a soundbite kind of culture in which the opposition often has a kind of pithy, quick, humorous even way of characterizing the issue. So how can we, I guess the challenge for you and I both, is to figure out ways to communicate what you just communicated, but not to do it in 500 words, but to figure out a way of doing it in 15 words. That's going to be the challenge for us as we go forward, because it's very easy to demand this kind of empirical science, and that it's quicker to be able to demand that than it is for us to explain why that's not necessary in this case. So that's, I think, the challenge we face.
And then related to that is the whole thing with theistic evolution is, the idea of for instance, many Christians even who are kind of thinking, well, we've got to go this route. The thing is, it's really, quite closely related to this, what we were just talking about, because, they'll focus on one particular piece of evidence, and it's kind of a slam dunk. This determines it all, instead of looking at the entire range of evidence and see which scenario can explain all of it. The inference to the best explanation.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Sorry, our connection is so distant, Tim. I'm sometimes talking over you. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's to say I'm on Skype, and so it's not necessarily the best connection. But for instance, this GLOW pseudogene that's been in the news a lot because of vitamin C production, and the people at at BioLogos, for instance, consider this to be kind of a slam dunk proof that humans have evolved, and it goes that life evolved according to Darwinian processes. But there's a whole range of other evidences that that are not explained by gradualism only, kind of Darwinism. And unless we insist equally that there's that you have to look at the whole range of evidence, not just one little piece of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And in your field, I mean, you know, when it came to, you know, the glove and the O.J. Simpson case, you know, that glove kind of, you know, that was the only thing you're looking at. Well, he's innocent, but you look at the whole range of evidence, and it doesn't quite fit that way.
Yeah, no doubt. And I can tell you that even as we kind of look at this issue, the issue of whether or not it's probably the best interview, single interview I've heard in the last maybe month and a half was, it's probably been a number of weeks now, Linda can help me, when Stephen Meyer came on the show here at STR and talked to Greg in the last hour of the show. To go back on the podcast at str.org and you can find this podcast. And one of the great things that Meyer said was, look, if ever there was a time to hop on and change the entire way you do theology based on an evolutionary theory, now is not the time, because this is the time when the theory is under the most challenge. And it was in March, Melinda just showed me. So get online and get that download. To me, that singular interview with Stephen C. Meyer was the best at really getting an insider's view of why it is that we ought to be very careful before we begin to realign ourselves in this way, thinking that evolution is such a slam dunk proposal that we need to rethink the way we do theology, the way we've considered our Christian explanation of origins. I think now is the time for us to be very cautious. Would you agree?
I agree. Yes, I listened to that interview too. It's really excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Tim, I appreciate you calling me on this question of theistic evolution. I know you wanted to make that distinction, and I think you did a good job of doing it. I appreciate your call.
Great.
All right. Thanks, Tim. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Let's go to Dave now on line two. Dave's calling from Indiana and wants to talk a little bit about same-sex marriage and how it is we communicate this idea to non-believers. How are you, Dave?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing good. And I know this is a difficult topic sometimes to talk about in the culture in which we live. So tell me what your experience has been and what your question is today.
Yeah. Actually, it was real interesting that you started off by mentioning getting to know the actual person more than the ideas, you know, that you need to connect with them. And this discussion is actually one that came up on Facebook, which is kind of hard, as you say, sit down and have a meal with somebody who's on the other side of the planet and responding every, you know, 6 hours to some chat, you know?
No, that's very true.
Yeah. But, so this is a buddy of mine I knew back in elementary school, junior high, and I reconnected with him, and we were chatting it up. Yeah, the same-sex marriage came up, and I was, you know, defending the Christian view that this is not healthy for society. And he immediately got on the defensive and was quite, you know, quite antagonistic about it. And he brought up, he brought up two things. The first thing really wasn't that much of a big deal. He mentioned, oh, well, there are all these, you know, liberal Christians who support same-sex marriage, which you know, that's neither here nor there. You know, it's what the scriptures say. But then he brought up that there was a report. This was kind of a jaw-dropping report to find out that there was a couple who had been foster parents for years and years and years in Britain, and apparently they had been denied to be foster parents simply because they weren't willing to say to the children they were caring for that homosexuality was a good thing. It was really tricky because what it sounded like he was trying to say was he was saying, you know, look, if you're a Christian and you want to be a foster parent, you know, you don't want society denying you those rights, and at the same time you're denying homosexuals the right to marry. And I mean, he at least that's what I was getting from what he was saying and bringing this up. And it was a really hairy issue, and I just didn't know how to respond to it, you know.
Well, this is the I think this is the issue going forward in this election cycle, going forward in our culture, which is going to be the most divisive and most difficult issue for us as Christians to navigate. I mean, this is the hot button issue. It draws out the most emotion. It draws out the most rhetorical flair on both sides. I mean, it's really going to be, I think, the issue that all of us are going to think carefully about and decide how it is we're going to respond to this and why it is we're going to respond in a given way. And I think one of the best and quickest ways, and again, you know, we always talk about how, you know, I've written about this topic, and so has Greg. And I know Alan and I yesterday were talking about it, as a matter of fact. And one of the talks that Alan gave, Alan Schliemann here at Stand to Reason, he gave a talk to young people yesterday about relationships from a Christian perspective and about the kind of sexual a view of sexuality that is from a Christian perspective. And I can tell you that this is an area that I think is going to be more and more important for our young people to be able to think it through. The problem, of course, is that it's very easy to kind of characterize and describe the issue from the other side using these short kind of soundbite responses. And a couple weeks ago, I think I was talking about Frank Turk a minute ago at this Cross-Examine Academy that he runs. We were sitting at coffee, and he made a good point, and I thought it's one of those. It's a step in the right direction, I think, at trying to explain what it is we think that government ought to be engaged in. There are certain things, and he uses three P words in order to describe this. There are certain things that government ought to prohibit, certain things that government ought to permit, and certain things that government ought to promote. And I think that we're not in a position as Christians to say that we believe that homosexual relationships should be prohibited. This has never been our claim. This is the way I think that people want to categorize us.
Yeah.
They want us to put us in that position that you Christians are against us and you want to prohibit the relationships we might have. And that isn't the issue at all. They already have the ability to form unions that we're talking about already. What we're saying is it in the best interest of culture to promote certain types of things? And if equal promotion of everything is the demand of people in our culture, I think we're going to be in trouble, because there are lots of other. Let's just get off the issue of same-sex relation of marriage or same-sex the relationships we're talking about here. And let's just move to another category. There are lots of things that we permit, but we don't promote. Although I got to tell you, I sometimes wonder if our culture isn't headed in this way. I recently was reading about I forget the name of the website that is offering $1 million to anybody who can substantiate or entice, I think, Tim Tebow into an extramarital affair. This website is out there in order to connect people to have extramarital affairs. And so that we're actually in a place now.
Wow.
Are we getting to, as a culture, do we want to promote this kind of behavior? We have to ask ourselves that question. And I think what we're saying here as Christians is, yes, there are some things we would prohibit, some things we would permit, and some things we would promote. We're not saying we're trying to prohibit this behavior or try to prohibit. We are saying that we are not going to promote same-sex marriage in a way that elevates it as an ideal. And now, there's lots of reasons why we might say that. And I think the approach I've taken is that I think, and I've written about it online, should government legalize same-sex marriage, is I'm looking at the well-being of young people who are being raised up in family settings. And I'm looking at it for that one perspective alone. And as much as you look at the research over and over and over again, year after year as it's being done, it's very hard to argue that the best way to raise up young people is in the context of their biological parents, mother and father, raising the kids in a family setting. And I haven't done this work in the last year, but about 3 years ago, I went through all the research that was current up to that point. I know there's a blogger called Wintery Knight who has done an even better job of updating all that research. So you can kind of Google for that blog post, and you'll find his work also kind of updates the research being done. But I think when you look at the research and what's happening in terms of a level of violence, level of success in school, level of all kinds of different measurement sticks that we use to determine the well-being of young people, it's just true that again and again you see these reports come back indicating that the best scenario for young people is to be raised with their biological mother and father. Now, I was not raised that way. I was raised in a single parent family. My mom raised me, okay? And I can tell you, you know, we all come out okay. We all do the best we can in that setting. But would it be the optimum thing I would promote for all of us? No, it wouldn't. And I'm now committed as a man to be in a long-term relationship with my wife to make sure that my kids have the opportunities that I didn't have. And I always say this, I was far more committed to marriage than I was to even my own wife. in all the years before I was a Christian, I understood the importance of that family unit that I didn't have growing up. And that's the thing I think we want to promote. I will permit all kinds of other things, though, don't get me wrong. And I'm not going to prohibit other things, but I'm not going to promote the things that are not optimal for young people. That's what's important to me. So it's a good question. Dave, I appreciate you calling. Go ahead. We're getting on a break here, but I'll give you one last chance to say something.
Yeah, and I wanted to respond specifically to that. It's interesting that you brought that up because the friend of mine who commented on this on Facebook, he was raised by a single mom as well. And that was the thing that I really need to try carefully because, I mean, he's met both my parents. I was raised by, you know, my mother and father. And to say to him, well, I think the optimal situation is for a kid to be raised by their biological mother and father, like, immediately he would come back and say, well, what's wrong with me? Why, you know, it's more than just a philosophical issue at that point. It's this personal attack. I think there was this recent book put out by a kid who was raised by two lesbian women, you know, like that. There's been a lot of, well, don't criticize my background, don't criticize my situation, and and I agree what you're saying about the numbers, but it's a hairy issue when it's personal like that. You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with you. Let me just say this is why it's really important for us to develop the relationships. This is really hard to do on Facebook. I'm going to tell you that right now. It's really hard to do even on email back and forth. There's been a lot of times when people will email me and they want to go into these kinds of conversations. Give me your number. I'll call and talk to you for 3 hours before I try to go back and forth. I mean, you need to hear the tone of my voice. Mm-hmm. You need to hear where I'm coming from. Also, I think we do have an advantage. I'm telling you that I experienced that also. I come from that background also of not having the perfect two-parent family, you know, growing up. How many of us actually have that? I think that most of us can relate to the idea. But if we're really honest with ourselves, we would say that I came out okay, I guess, but I hope for better for my own kids. I mean, I hope I can do better in terms of holding together this family unit than my parents were able to do. And that doesn't say anything bad about my parents or anything bad about me personally. It's just that I know that the best I can give my kids is to hold together that ideal. So that's where I'm coming from. And it's true, though, I think when you're talking to somebody, maybe you're coming out of a two-parent family that has not experienced these kinds of issues, it will be hard for you to connect with people who have come from a broken setting. And that's where I think it's time for us to get off the Facebook and get onto a personal conversation and maybe understand that you may not be able to go very far with people you don't know personally, that you can't invest in personally, right? So they can't see where your heart really is. But some good points and some good admonitions about how to deal with Facebook as well. So I appreciate your call, Dave. Thanks a lot. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, here we are at the quick break here. We'll come back in about 2 minutes right here on Stand to Reason Radio.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive Making Abortion Unthinkable prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Last month, I took 17 Christian high school students on the Muslim Mission. This is a 4-day trip where they got to practice their skills in apologetics and evangelism. Find out what happened on this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Get it from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
Back at Stand to Reason, listening to the music of Doug Powell, our guest in the third hour, and looking forward to talking to him. And enjoying so far our conversations together, talking about the things that matter most, the stuff that makes your brain get warm and fuzzy as you think about issues of ethics, values, and religion. And this is what this is all about, right? Clear thinking Christianity here. And Greg is away for the weekend, so I am going to be with you the rest of this 3-hour period of time and looking forward to getting all of your questions. Our numbers here, toll-free, 1-800-227-5278, and locally at 714-754-4150. And we're going to go to Mark in Canton, Ohio. It's so cool about doing this show is getting to talk to people all over the country. So, Mark, how are you doing?
Hi, doing great, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Looking forward to talking to you. Now, you got a question, a challenge about what is it on the big one we always deal with, which is Christian hypocrisy, right?
Right. This is a situation that I've come across a couple times, and just to give you a little background,
okay.
I've been studying the tactics issues or tactics to defending the faith for the last 6-8 months.
Good.
In preparation for teaching it to my Bible class at a church.
Good.
And so in preparing to do this, I've decided to talk with an atheist friend of mine, and I kind of called him out and I said, hey, I'd like to sit down with you and see what are your objections to Christianity so that I can have kind of a little taste of what it's like to be out there and be an apologist and to find out what his objections are directly.
Yes.
And to find out maybe what my answer should be or how I would just kind of handle that, just getting my first taste of that.
Sure.
And so I talked with him on the phone to kind of get that set up, and we haven't had that meeting yet, but one of the things he did say was the hypocrite issue. All Christians are hypocrites, and like I said, this is an issue that I had personally with a friend, and I didn't know the terminology at the time, but this other friend that I worked with was quite the steamroller. He was just not interested in any answers. He was interested in just saying, hey, I gotcha, because he found something after quite some time of finding a flaw, and he really jumped all over it. So this atheist friend of mine is not so much the steamroller, but he did mention the hypocrite. And so trying to think of things in terms of the Columbo questions, I was trying to think what is the real response or the best response to the challenge that Christians are hypocrites. And after, you know, getting out of that conversation, think about it for a second, I thought my first Columbo question might be, what qualifies as a hypocrite in your definition?
That's right. That's what I was going to say to you. If I was going to work with you as a coach, I'd be asking you to assume the positions. Let's assume the tactics that we typically talk about. You're going to want to ask good questions. And so you're going to have to define the word hypocrite for sure. So did you ask that question to your friend? What did he say?
Have not had a chance to do that yet, but I was thinking, regardless of what his response is, I'm thinking, well, would there be differing degrees of what hypocrisy means to him? Because if he's looking for me to walk on water, he's going to catch me on that one, obviously.
Right.
And then on the lower end of that scale, I do have human failings, and I do make mistakes. And so in the previous situation years ago, you know, I said, well, yes, I'm guilty as charged. I mean, I will make mistakes. I will not be the perfect example of Christianity for you because I'm not trying to be the perfect example of Christianity. But is there something better than guilty as charged?
Well, there's also a second question you're going to need to ask him, too. Is he's making the claim that all Christians...
How did he come to that conclusion?
Well, yes, but he's also asking that all... He's making the statement that all Christians are hypocrites. So when I want to know, what does he mean? Does he really believe that of the, you know, the entire population of Christians on the planet, there's not a single one? Or does he really mean that his experience has been that he's bumped into a large number of these, and so that's the kind of the taste that's left in his mouth? I want to know, what does he really mean when he says all Christians are hypocrites? Does he mean there's something about Christianity in itself that is inherently hypocritical? Or does he mean that really, I've had an experience of, you know, 30 or 40 Christian friends, and these 30 or 40 Christian friends, I find that they're hypocritical. Now, that's really the question I'm going to need to ask, because I think that you know as well as I do that anytime someone uses the word always or never, those are the two words that make you a liar faster than anything else, because very seldom is anything always or never the case. So there's going to be some exceptions to every one of these kinds of claims. And I would, like you, I think the first thing I would do is ask the good penetrating questions to find out what is hypocrisy. Is hypocrisy a single misstep when I know what my values are and I know what my perception of reality is based in? Are there times, am I allowed to make a single misstep in navigating my claims? Am I allowed to make a single mistake? Or is it about a consistent, repeated, willful disregard to the things I say I believe, where I'm actually celebrating the exact opposite of what it is I claim to believe? That's a little bit different. And I want to kind of mine that out. I want to find out, you know, which of these two things do we think are at play here with your friend? Because I think I'm quick, like you probably, to say, you know what, I'm absolutely a hypocrite. There's no doubt about it. If you're looking for somebody who's a perfect example of Christianity, don't look at Jay Warner, okay, because that's just not going to – I'll make a fool of the entire system. But but the difference is that I don't celebrate – the things I used to anymore before I was a Christian.
Okay.
That's the difference, is that now on this side of my profession of faith, I still make the mistakes. And it bugs me as much as it bugs the people who are watching me. And so, yes, you're right. The problem, of course, is that all of us are hypocrites if what we mean is we occasionally do or say something that betrays the things we claim are true. I don't know anybody who can live their worldview without any blemish, regardless of what their worldview may be.
Including the guy who's the atheist.
Including the guy, you know, yesterday, for example, and this is the other issue, too, is if the problem is that you guys believe a certain thing but you don't seem to be able to live it, that's very different than okay, so what? What does that really say about what we believe? It says nothing about what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
It just says something about us individually. The claim still has to be addressed on its merit. Is the thing we believe true or not? Whether or not we can live it, that's a whole other issue. To say that, you know, the fact that you guys see hypocrites, I see lots of hypocrites who are secularists. So, I mean, believe me, I was one for 35 years. I'm no less a hypocrite now probably than I ever was. I think I now feel shame over the things I used to say, yeah, and celebrate. Because now I understand how powerful the differences are.
So when I responded to the former situation, I said, "Well, you're absolutely right. I'm guilty as charged. I'm not the angel you seem to think you want to shoot down here, because you know you've caught me in an attitude about this or that is contrary to the Christian living, and you're going to exploit that."
Yeah, well, I think in the end, you know as well as I do, Mark, that hypocrisy is part of the human condition, part of the human fallen nature. I don't care what kind of an organization you peer into. We open the door and take a look and see what's going on inside. I don't care if it's Christianity or any other worldview. You're going to find hypocrisy. You're going to find failure. You're going to find people who miss the mark. But the Christian worldview is the only worldview that allows for forgiveness, true forgiveness of our human failing. In the end, I would suggest that, yes, I'm a hypocrite, no doubt about it. There are times when I catch my own hypocrisy, but I bet I'm no more or less than you are when it comes to your own worldview. But I sit in a position in this worldview where I think I understand a little bit about my own hypocrisy now. I'm far more repentant. I know people who are hypocrites, and they're unrepentant hypocrites.
Okay.
That's the thing I don't want to be anymore. What I don't want to be is an unrepentant hypocrite. And so if you find yourself in that position and you're an unrepentant hypocrite, I would have to ask, are you really a follower of Christ?
Mm-hmm.
And by definition, you may have moved yourself out of that position. I'm not trying to be perfect anymore, but I feel the shame of my imperfection, whereas before I never felt it before. I sometimes say that the only difference between now and then is that now I'm a little less happy about who I am. You know, I try to do better. but I often find myself failing, and I'm less and less happy about my failures. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Now, in the case of the steamroller, in that case, what he was looking at, I mean, he went a long time. I mean, he pretty much cultivated a friendship, did the invite to dinner thing, and I really think there was some subterfuge there because he invited me to dinner, and we talked, and nothing major controversial came up, but it wasn't too much longer after that, and I'd known him for maybe 6 months, eight months, and too much longer after that, he found his flaw, and boy, there was just wasn't anything that was going to convince him that anything was different, and that there, you know, so it was, he just saw what he wanted to see, and he I guess he boosted his own view by saying, "Ha, I got one."
Well, and I think at this point we have to realize, too, is that we sometimes think that we're in a game here of just dealing with the rational objections of people. And you know as well as I do that that's only one part of it. As a matter of fact, I think sometimes it's a minor part of it. Our friends are rejecting for rational, emotional, and volitional reasons. Sometimes I think, Mark, the best thing we can do in that situation is to be on our knees praying for the people who are around us, that God will do something in them so that our rationality begins to make sense in their own lives. But we're coming up to the end of the hour. Dave in Alaska, I'm so sorry I didn't get to you. I will hold you over if you can stay with us. It'll be the first question up in the next hour after the opening monologue, okay? Hour one is now in the books. I'm looking forward to talking to you for the next 2 hours right here on Stand to Reason Radio. Radio show with you guys. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. As you know, I sometimes get a chance to host for Greg when he's out of town, and I am pleased to be here today, especially from 3 to 5, because you know, that's more on the American Family Radio Network. And so welcome to all of you who are joining us now in our second hour. Our first hour was great. Had some good questions, and we talked a little bit about some tactics that I might use when dealing with conversations and interrogations and interactions with suspects. And some of these have some transfer value into your conversations with people who are skeptics or would push back against the claims of Christianity. So I hope you'll go back and listen to the podcast for that first hour. Either way, I'm glad to be back here kind of helping with basic training for your mind and clear-thinking Christianity. And I happen to have, sometimes this first 20 minutes you spend time just talking in kind of a monologue, some issues are important to you. And I get the great chance this hour to talk to my buddy, let me punch him in here, Alan Schliemann, who of course is one of the speakers here at Stand to Reason. And I was with you yesterday, Alan, all day at a conference. That was a lot of fun. I'm glad to have you on the line with me. Alan, I know you're there.
Hear me?
Let me see. Hang on. I can barely hear him, folks. Let me see if I can get him. How about now? Do you hear me now, Alan?
Okay.
Hey, we're so
cool. Can you hear me now?
Well, listen, it's probably not anyone's fault but me. You know, I get in this studio and all these buttons to push, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. You know, podcasting is a very different experience. You know, you just hit the recorder on or off, you know, and you can make a mistake and rewind and start all over again. Unfortunately, this is a little less forgiving. So, Alan, good to have you with me, and I really enjoyed yesterday out there in Redlands at the Truth Is Conference. What did you think?
Yeah, I loved it. It was great. I mean, I think that was their first time putting on a conference like this, and they had a great turnout, and it was fairly well organized, and everything went great. So it was great.
So let me ask you, Alan. I know when you first started, did you think you'd be doing this much work with young people?
No, I didn't. And in fact, when Brett, had this emphasis with youth, I kind of thought, oh, all right, well, I'll be working with a lot with adults and. And that was fine for me. But I think as we've all started to realize that the topics that I've been dealing with, especially with the topic of homosexuality, which is what I spoke on yesterday, this is a huge topic for youth, for high school, for college, even for some younger than high school. So It makes sense that this is a topic that younger audiences are going to want to know about and be prepared to deal with as they face challenges every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've had a couple of tough topics here, huh, working at Standard Reason. You're the one who does most of the training on Islam as well. And that's the thing I really was looking forward to talking to you about today, because it wasn't that long ago, but last month, first part of the month, that we went on a one-week adventure. It's the first ever Islam missions trip that we've taken with STR. And I wanted just to take some time with you to describe it to people, and the value of it, and what actually occurred in that, 4 or 5 days we were together with a relatively small group. Now, when we started the Berkeley trip, I think that first year, we might have had about the same number of young people we had at the Islam trip. I think we had about, 20 or so high school seniors, freshmen through seniors, who went with us on this trip, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wasn't on that one, but that's what I've heard as well.
No, but as far as the STR Islam trip, I think we had 17 to 20 on that trip as well. Tell me, how did you get involved with Brett? When did he come to you and say, hey, Alan, we're going to be doing this crazy trip. Are you interested in being a part of it?
Well, I mean, of course, I've known about these trips for a while, and I've done a kind of a similar thing with the pro-life mission, doing training Christians to defend a pro-life view and then going out into, kind of the people on the street and engaging them and kind of practicing your skills. So Brett was doing this with the Mormon trip and, of course, the atheist trip. And naturally, because I was speaking on the topic of homosexuality, this is a question that came up. And I think there are some of the groups that he had taken, I perhaps had asked about perhaps this issue and whether a trip like this could be put together. And so I kind of got in that conversation, I don't know, maybe at least a year ago or longer. And that's when we started to kind of brainstorm about the idea and think, you know, could we do something like this, but focus specifically on Muslims and going to mosques and getting right in there and engaging Muslims and, you know, seeing what we can do with training Christians to be better equipped to reach out to these people.
Exactly. That's really the goal here, isn't it? It's not – this is the thing that I think there's some confusion, and you and I have to be realistic about our goals when working with young people in this setting. Sometimes you think of a missions trip, and you think, well, the goal is to go out and share the gospel with people who have not heard it. And, of course, that's an important goal. But there are other things that occur as you train up young people to interact with any other worldview, especially Islam. And so what were some of the goals that you saw were important for us going into this in terms of what we were going to accomplish with young people?
Well, I think the key is training. And by training, and this is something I've talked a lot about, I don't just mean, you know, sitting at a lecture, listening to somebody talk to you about some subject, you know, whatever it is, and then maybe even having some Q&A and saying, okay, now these people are trained. That's not training. And so what we try to do is we say, look, we want to train these people in such a way that they walk away with confidence and the skills to be able to engage, you know, Muslims or whatever the issue is in the future. And so what we do is we first the way we kicked this whole training off was I did a role play where I pretended to be a Muslim to several classes of these Christian high school students. And so they thought they were engaging a real Muslim who had come into this Christian high school. And so I did all sorts of things and made all sorts of arguments in favor of the Islamic point of view and challenged their Christian kind of their faith. And then eventually, of course, we, you know, let him in on the joke, not the joke, but the kind of the trick, I guess, if you will, that I was actually a Christian. But it gave them an opportunity to see that they were not prepared to deal with a Muslim kind of, you know, taking them on in their convictions. And so from then on, they were trained with other lectures, they were trained with books, you know, role play, different kinds of things where they were able to kind of get trained in terms of from an academic perspective. And so once we felt they were adequate for that, then we said, all right, now let's take you on the trip. And that's when the 4-day trip started that we were on together. And so, you know, the goals then are about, I see them twofold. One is simply understanding apologetics to Islam. So knowing the arguments, knowing the things that you're going to be challenged by Muslims, knowing the most kind of common approaches that they'll take with regards to what they believe about you as a believer. And so allowing them to go kind of head-to-head with these Muslims, real Muslims, who really disagree with them. And so that's one aspect of it. But, of course, as you mentioned, the other aspect is just simply the task of evangelism, which is part of the Great Commission, you know, trying to bring the gospel to these people, share your faith with them, because at the end of the day, this isn't merely an academic exercise. We actually want to win hearts and souls for Jesus Christ. And so this Muslim mission accomplishes both of those objectives. It trains them in apologetics to Islam, but it also gives them an opportunity to share their faith and their convictions and try to win others to Christ. So the beauty of it is it's got those two objectives, but then also it incorporates real training, and that's what I mean by you teach them this stuff in a classroom setting, you role play, you do all sorts of things to get them ready, but then you get them out into the real mission field. You go into a mosque and you invite the mosque to bring their top guys, to bring their scholars, to bring their kind of evangelists, to give the most compelling arguments that Islam has to offer, and then you kind of see what those students can do in terms of responding back and asking tough questions and engaging these guys. And that's exactly what we were able to watch, and then kind of provide feedback for them. So they learn this stuff kind of academically. We role play it. Then we have them go into the real setting and talk to real Muslims, and then we give them feedback as to how they did, and then they try it again with another group of Muslims. And so this is what real training is about. And so when they walk away from this four-day trip, they have a confidence to share their faith with any Muslim they're going to run into, either at school or, you know, just kind of out in the community. They have a confidence to share their faith with them because they've done this, and they've been trained by people who know what they're talking about, and they've had an opportunity to see how they can do, and then have critical feedback that is helpful to kind of help them, you know, hone their skills. And so this is what real training is about, and this is what the Muslim mission provides.
Okay, now, you know, when we first started doing these missions trips, we started with the Utah trip and then the Berkeley trip, and you're doing the pro-life trip, and now this Islam trip. I mean, of all of them, I sensed a certain elevated sense of apprehension on the part of either parents or students about taking this particular trip. Did you sense that as well?
I did. I didn't sense it as much as, you know, the school did, because, of course, they were more directly in contact with the parents and stuff. But from what I heard, that was a legitimate concern. And, I mean, or I should say it was a concern expressed by people.
Sure.
And I could see why they're saying this. You know, I mean, Islam has a lot of, you know, a lot of press about, you know, certain things that they do. And some Muslims can be very aggressive. There's no question about that. And I think we're aware of that. You know, from what I heard, there were people that probably would have came had it not been a Muslim mission trip.
Right.
But because it was, they probably were a little bit more hesitant, either the students themselves or parents. So,
and of course,
yeah,
that kind of transfers over to leadership as well. So when you get involved in this is our first time doing this kind of a trip. Are there certain principles of these types of mission trips that I think are highly valuable? One of them is great training before the event and a sustained training before the event, where we did that. I first got involved like you. I was asked to come in the first couple of weeks just to kind of train up on the deity of Christ, to kind of get our foundation set before we start to kind of look at the issues that Islam's going to challenge us with. And then we do this for how many weeks? I think 8 weeks we spent on and off. They actually, every week for 8 weeks, met during one period of time at school, meeting and going through different texts, going through different books that were being offered to them. So it's sustained training up front. But the next important thing, I think, is you've got to kind of take your group and just pull them out of their comfort zone and put them someplace where they're not going to be sleeping at home. They're going to be kind of sequestered together and have to. And so we did that. We took them out to not far from where we started, about maybe about an hour and a half away, just far enough away that they couldn't go home every night. And they were forced to kind of hang out together. And that meant that all of our downtime, I mean, this trip especially, it seemed to me like there wasn't much downtime. And it was constant training or engaging. For 4 days. I mean, I've been on trips where we give them an hour here to play some music or an hour to hang out. We didn't even have much of that. These folks worked hard. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, they definitely worked hard. I mean, there were times when we had, you know, worship time, just by ourselves. So it wasn't all work, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it was a pretty packed schedule. I think it worked well. I mean, we had time where we, like you said, we were engaging people, but then we would debrief after every single engagement, whether it was street evangelism, whether we were going to a mosque, a Shiite mosque or a Sunni mosque, or whether we were having Muslims share their testimony, and then we were, you know, being, you know, having an opportunity to, you know, ask them questions. I think every time we had an opportunity to debrief with the students, and kind of see kind of where they're at, what they made of it, and for us to give them feedback as to how they did as well.
And I think one of the things we learn, and we always learn this when we do these kinds of trips, is that people of every worldview, there are always going to be some people who will be maybe a little more disagreeable, maybe a little harder to interact with, but there's always going to be somebody there who's going to be winsome. And we experienced that too on this trip. We met several Muslim presenters who came into our group who were really charming and winsome, in addition to having, you know, some pushback from people who were maybe a little more aggressive. But what was, I think, important for our young people to see how powerful your character is in trying to make a case for what you believe. That last presenter we had the last Friday before we came home, I thought he was very powerful in just the way he connected with our students. And that's, I think, something we take for granted a lot. And even when we're training our young people to go on these trips, is the nature of and the important role of character, which, of course, STR has always made a point of advocating. So,
yeah, I mean, that – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, that guy was especially interesting because we had invited him to come to the church we were staying at. So here is a Muslim coming to this church. And so he's kind of on, you know, enemy territory in a certain sense. But he was so comfortable and so relaxed, and he's a college student, and he's not your average age college student. I think he's had a wife and kids, but still, he was a college student, and so he was so.
Oh, I think we just lost Alan. I'll just continue until he gets back on the line with you. That was a very, very powerful object lesson for us on this trip. And what I've discovered is that when you have people who come into your group, and they will be speaking on the opposite side of the issue, is that when they're closer to the same age as the group we're actually dealing with, we had high schoolers. If you've got, for example, in Berkeley, somebody who's college-aged, who's part of an atheist group, when they come into the group, that's really powerful. They're more culturally relevant. They speak more the same language. And they are endearing to the age group we're dealing with in a way that older folks just – I'm sorry, I'm 51. I don't feel like I'm that much older. But it's true that there's a difference between how older folks can, you know, especially when we go to Berkeley, sometimes the first couple of years we did it, we would engage people who maybe were much older than our young people. They were sometimes a little crankier, a little more aggressive. And then we had a young guy come into our group who was a leader at the Berkeley campus, and he was maybe only 3 or 4 years older than the kids we were there with. And he was so ingratiating and winsome and attractive that – his testimony as an atheist was very powerful. And what it taught us coming out of that was, hey, you know, if you have somebody who's there who – and Alan, I think I have you back on the line, don't I?
Yeah.
We were just talking about how young people come who are more culturally relevant. It's not even so much that they have to be correct about what they're saying or that their worldview has to be true. But let's face it, the young people we're dealing with that we brought along with us are far more likely to gravitate toward that position on the basis of that young man's character and his kind of cultural relevance and is closer to their age. And that's, I think, sometimes can be a danger, but it's something we need to present to our young people so they'll be prepared.
Yeah, you're still talking about the last
presenter we had that day. I mean, I want to ask you this, too, because we're going to get close to our break here, and I'm sorry that once in a while we drop a call, and I apologize for that. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, too, is you've had a chance now to present as an STR speaker to adults and to young people. And I know there's a difference, and I get a chance to do both of those as well. And what I've learned, though, is that the young people can really do a lot more with the information than we give them credit for. Just tell me what your experience has been now that you've had a chance to present this kind of information to young people. What do you think are the liabilities? What are the takeaways? What are the things that you've learned as a presenter that help you be effective with young people?
Oh, well, that's a lot to think about there. I think that one of the advantages that we have with working with young people is that they have, I think, a lot more flexibility in their lifestyle to kind of do the things that we do. I mean, I think to get a group, say, of adults to do the same kind of a thing, although possible, would be a little bit more difficult just because of the very nature of the lifestyle that adults have with jobs and other kinds of commitments. And young people have usually far fewer commitments, and if they do have commitments, they're usually more flexible. And so this is why these trips work so well with young people, is because they have that flexibility, and that's one of the nice things is we can teach them these things, but it doesn't just remain as abstract academic information. It's stuff that they could put into practice because they can go out, you know, take 4 days, you know, sleep on the floor, shower at the beach, you know, do all sorts of things.
That
make them very,
that make them very, very flexible. I mean, they were wearing swimsuits, of course, but yeah. So I think that's one of the huge advantages. You know, there also seems to be, to me, kind of a for a lot of young people, just have a tremendous amount of passion about their faith. You know, the kind of people that would come on a trip like this perhaps are just generally people who are very passionate about their convictions. But I guess I've just seen a lot of times this is the case where you have these people who are so passionate that they're willing to kind of do the things that perhaps maybe an adult audience wouldn't be willing to do.
Yeah, I see
and,
that too.
You know, mm-hmm. put themselves in circumstances that are perhaps very, very challenging. And again, I'm not saying that adults wouldn't do that, but I sense kind of a vibrancy about, you know, young people and their faith sometimes that makes it a huge advantage towards doing something like this.
Yeah, and also I've noticed this too as a youth pastor that I used to think, well, if I'm going to teach this topic, whatever this topic is, if it's going to be the cosmological argument or it's going to be some deep theological position, I'm going to try to teach how to defend the Trinity, whatever it may be. I used to think, well, okay, I would, if, as an adult talking to another adult, I might go this way, but I'm not sure these young people can handle it. And what I learned was doing this over a period of years is that, no, they can handle it. And it's really about, there's a lot of passion and energy in that room. And I'm not going to anymore, I won't spend a lot of time anymore undercutting or underselling what the young people can do, what they can apprehend, what they can actually get their teeth into. And I think you found that too on this trip. We didn't lower the bar for these kids. We kept the bar really high, and we talked about issues in a very detailed way. And I mean, if you were to think about the number of hours we spent talking to people or being trained, it's amazing what we asked these young people to do, and they were up for it. They were willing to do it. That's, yeah. I think, does that surprise you when you teach young people how much they are capable of consuming and of really digesting?
Well, I think I've been doing it for a while now, and I think I'm perhaps surprise isn't the word, but just I'm always pleased to see it, you know, and they love it, you know. It's not like we were making them do all these tough things and not, you know, and keeping the bar raised, and they were just kind of like, you know, begrudgingly going through this and going through the motions. They were loving it. They were eating it up, and they were passionate about, you know, going further with it. So it's just, I think their attitude about it was great, and that just brought so much joy, I think, to us as leaders on the trip.
Yeah, absolutely.
That excitement about it. So, I mean, it was fun for them. You know?
Yeah, no, the things that we would think, if I was to describe this trip to adults, a lot of adults I would describe this trip to would probably say, that was fun. I mean, it doesn't sound like what I might do for fun, but what's so great about young people is we can get them excited about this. And what made that happen, I think it made it so effective, was that first day you spent with them in which you role played and showed them their weaknesses. And nobody feels comfortable sitting in that kind of a weak position where you don't know how to respond to these objections. So immediately they were compelled to do the hard work, to do the heavy lifting, to get better at something they felt very bad about. They didn't feel like they did it. A couple of them, I think, felt like they could hold their own. But for the most part, those students felt like you just ate them up. And they didn't like that feeling. And they wanted to spend the next few weeks, well, 8 weeks, getting ready to make sure that never happened again. And I think that was the great and that's why role-playing is so important to what we do in training these young groups. Now, we're getting up on this break here, Alan, so I'm going to go ahead and let you go. But I want to just thank you for helping me. Now, I really thought yesterday when I saw you, I wanted to make sure that we expressed this trip to people because I think it was an important trip. And I hope that we learn enough from it to maybe do it again. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. That'll
okay, thanks great. So much, John. I appreciate your time on the phone. So I want to go ahead and say goodbye to you right now. And for the rest of you who are listening and I'm waiting to try to call them, we have a couple of people on the queue. But we've got some room, I think, on the lines. Call us at 1-800-227-5278 or locally 714-754-4150. And we'll be right back here in 2 minutes on Stand to Reason.
Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that we are all ambassadors for Christ. This verse has guided STR's mission from the beginning, helping you and other Christians to grow as ambassadors for Christ. And it's why we created a new series of booklets called The Ambassador's Guide. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. Our newest release in this timely series is on the subject of Islam. Written by STR speaker Alan Schliemann, this booklet is a vital resource to prepare you with the knowledge and wisdom to better understand the Muslim faith while sharing Christ in an effective manner, a skill that will be especially valuable in the changing world at our doorsteps. Other topics in the series include the New Atheists and Postmodernism, with other subjects coming out this year. To order your copy of The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, or any title in The Ambassador's Guide series, call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or order online at str.org.
What kind of faith are you passing on to your young people? Is it blind and irrational, or is it reasonable? This is Brett Kunkel, and in this month's Bulletproof Podcast, I'll discuss the biblical view of faith young believers need to hear from us. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad. Available for free from iTunes or the Android market, you can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Here today on Stand to Reason, Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg, trying to give you peace of my mind. It's not as, I'll just tell you up front, it's not as good as Greg's mind, okay? But I'll do my best. And we're going to talk to Jay, to Dave, actually, in Juneau, Alaska, here on line four. And Dave, did you call in last week from Juneau?
I did.
You know, I remember the pun that Greg used, so I'm not going to use the same pun again, okay? Because I think when he said he did it last week that he got a glaringly bad look from Melinda. She was not happy with that pun, so I won't do the same pun again this week. So you're calling about science and logic. Go ahead and tell me what your thoughts are.
I am. So I'm having this discussion with my atheist friend, and essentially what I said was there are several things that science cannot prove or account for, but that are rational to accept. And I listed the five things that William Lane Craig has listed in previous arguments and that yes. are on page 126 of Norman Geisler and Frank Turk's book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist.
Right.
And the first thing was that science cannot prove mathematics and logic, because it has to assume those very things to prove that they are true.
Right.
And his comment was that mathematics and logic stand on their own as true, regardless of whether science can prove them or not. And so I'm wondering what the best response to that might be. My initial response was that well, for something to be true, it would normally have to have a referent, and science claims that mathematics and logic are the tools of science, and you know, therefore it's all true. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas, Jay, on what the best response would be.
Yeah, I think this is a difficult challenge to face for a couple of reasons. And Dave, I think part of it is that this is an area that many of us don't feel adequately prepared to discuss what in some ways is a key objection to the transcendental argument, for example. How do we kind of move past an objection, which sometimes just sounds like it's basically like this. Hey, aren't the laws of logic just simply brute characteristics of existence? You know, both material and immaterial things, they've got to abide by boundaries of existence in order to exist in the first place. And the laws of logic are simply among the boundaries, the characteristics of existence. So they're not, in this case, I think he would say they're not transcendent laws from a transcendent mind. They're just a few of the natural boundaries of existence. Is that, I think it's pretty much where he's coming from. Would you agree?
Right, I would agree.
Okay, so this is how I've approached it in the past, and you can take your two cents for whatever it's worth for you. I come at it from this perspective. Both, I think, the theist and the atheist would have to agree that the laws of logic are brute somethings. The atheist would claim they're brute innate facts of existence, but as a theist, I would argue that they're the brute innate reflection and of the nature and the thinking of God. In either case, though, I think that these laws would have to be eternal, uncaused, and necessary by nature. Would you agree?
Sure, I would agree.
Okay, so nothing really can exist without the simultaneous existence of these, or the kind of foundational existence of these laws. But now let's take just a step and look at how both sides, both you and I, and he might account for their existence. And that's what it really comes down to. It's not that we're trying to – it really comes down to how we account for their existence. The atheist, I think, would have to say that the brute laws of logic simply exist. They are eternal and uncaused, and nothing can exist without them. That's just the way it is. There's no point in even asking that question. They simply exist. And I think what you and I would say is, well, if there's any God at all, he would by definition be eternal, uncaused, omniscient, omnipotent. He would be the all-knowing, the all-powerful God that is the necessary uncaused first cause of all matter, of all space, all time. He'd have the attributes like thoughts and character and essence and nature. And if he is truly as powerful and all-knowing as we say he is, these attributes would be perfect. An all-powerful and all-knowing God has the power to eliminate imperfection, right? So we would say that logic then is simply an attribute of God's perfect existence. It is innate and it's intrinsic to God's own perfect thought process. God's thoughts would by necessity be consistent with God, with himself. So God does not create these laws of logic. They are an innate and immutable aspect of his nature. And that's how we would respond. We would say that as God is necessary for all else to exist, so are the laws of logic. They're merely a reflection of God's nature, and they permeate all of his creation. Now, that's the kind of response I would give. And I think that if you look at those two responses, and you just stop for a second and assess the two responses, that's where I think we artists has power. I mean, both the atheist and the theist, they agree that something is eternal, uncaused, and necessary. But when the atheist says to you, and your friend says to you, that the laws of logic simply exist, I think he's really begging the question. He's not providing an explanation for their eternal, uncaused, and necessary existence, because just saying that they exist, that doesn't provide us with some way to account for their existence. So that's the problem I see, that the atheist fails to explain how these laws can be eternal and uncaused and what role they play in causing all the other contingent realities. I think the theist, you and I, have a better explanation, because we can account for the existence of the laws of logic. We can point these to the existence of an omniscient, omnipotent, uncaused first cause that possesses perfect rationality by virtue of his limitless power. And we can also this cause then can act as the first cause of all other contingent creation. So I think that if you look at the way these two answers kind of cash out, both of us have to explain this. And I think that the theistic explanation is, just on its face, much more robust and satisfying than simply saying, hey, this is just the way it is. And that's where I would kind of challenge him, I think, is I think I would say, hey, it sounds like if I was to tell you, if you had a question about the nature of God, for example, you had a question about God, God's existence, and I was to come back and say, hey, it's just the way it is. God simply exists. That's a stupid question to ask. Well, that's not a satisfying question in this direction, and I don't think it's a satisfying response in the other direction as well.
Right.
So I'm not sure if that helps you.
Well, it does. And when I pose things like this, he just says, you're impossible, Dave.
Yeah. Well,
and he goes away. So I'm just brainstorming and hoping to plant rocks in the shoe.
Yeah, let me just offer another way of kind of looking at this too, is that, look, all of these pieces, I don't really, in every circumstantial case I've ever done as an investigator that I've ever had to go to trial with, I never had a slam dunk piece of evidence. You know, I've never had the smoking gun, the piece of DNA that removes all doubt. I mean, for me, I'm always making cases on their cumulative nature. There's not just, and when I do a presentation like I did yesterday, I typically show a case that I can build on 8 or 9 or 10 pieces of evidence, right? And I try to show people how a cumulative circumstantial case can be very powerful, and most people have no problem at all, saying yes, this is, coming to a conclusion about guilt, based on the nature of just the 8 pieces I gave them in the talk, right? But in reality, when I get to a real case in trial, we're going to have 30 or 50 pieces of evidence, all of which assembled together and have to be explained in their totality. And it's always going to be possible for defense attorneys to come along and pick off one explanation at a time. So, you know, piece of evidence A is attributed to this thing and B is attributed to that thing. So I might have 30 explanations, divergent explanations of how these 30 pieces of evidence came to, into being. Or I have one common explanation for all 30 pieces of evidence, and I've got to ask the jury, which of these two scenarios is most reasonable? That 30 unfortunate coincidences lined up to make it look like the suspect is guilty, or that he is the one singular cause to account for all 30 pieces of evidence. So when I'm looking at the arguments that we offer for God's existence, and I look at this argument from the existence of logic, I think it's to me it's never and I can tell you my son, Jimmy, who's 23, we argue about this all the time, right? Because he doesn't believe this is a good argument for God's existence. I think it's an excellent argument, but I think it's one piece of a cumulative case for sure. And so I would look at it and say, hey, I don't know how you can deny, when the entire puzzle's put together, the strength of all of these different arguments that all are best explained by the existence of God. Certainly, the atheist can find another explanation, an alternative explanation, and they're going to have to do that repeatedly with the issues from cosmology, from teleology, from axiology, from this argument, from fine-tuning anthropic principle, from all kinds of different pieces of evidence we're going to bring to them. They're going to have to find a way to explain away all of those pieces of evidence. In the end, though, we know we've got a large body. As a matter of fact, in the theism section on my website at Please Convince Me, I assemble what I call the case for the Christian worldview, and I try to put the depth of this circumstantial case all on one page so you can see that we're not relying on a stool that has one leg, and it's the transcendental argument. This is one of a large body of evidence that we're putting together cumulatively to make a case for Christianity. And I think that if you look at it that way, that you're spot on, Dave. This is a powerful argument, but it has to be recognized and evaluated in the context of all the other pieces. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, and that makes perfect sense because I used to work in forensic psychology. So, you know, I would have to pull in, and because I was working with adult and juvenile sex offenders, so I'd have to pull in, you know, all of the evidence, all the police reports, all the victim statements, all of these things. And, of course, they would want to deny that in therapy that they were guilty of nothing when the evidence was overwhelming. So maybe I should go back and kind of study my own former field.
Well, I think as we describe this to people, and when we see it, when we impanel a jury, we ask the jury in advance, do you understand that the nature of circumstantial evidence? Do you understand the nature of cumulative cases? And if people really have refuse to or have a resistance to wanting to even examine a case this way, then we make sure that we don't impanel them, because this is the nature of how we reason through evidence in a case. And if we have some prior bias against looking at evidence this way, then you're not going to overcome that. And you're going to have to, and this may be the case here. I mean, again, we'd like to believe that everything is all rejection to this truth claim is based in rationality. A lot of the rejection that I still have on lots of things is not based on rationality. It's based on some emotional objection I have or some volitional objection I have. I want to make sure, though, when it comes to the things of God, that I can kind of sort out the differences and make sure that I'm letting my mind reason me towards something and I'm not just knee-jerking emotionally or because I have I want to live a certain way, and I want to be God, and I don't want there to be a God other than me. So I have to make sure that I'm really staying in the realm of rationality. And I think this is what we have to do with our friends we're talking to. Here's the bigger problem we have. We don't often take the time to see if their real objection is stemming from which of these three areas is their real objection. Which of these three areas does their life inform us that this is the real issue, is this? We always assume it's if I can give you the better argument, if I can give you the better piece of evidence, I'm done. But it's almost never the case. It's always there's some combination of these three factors we've got to be able to understand. And that's why we need to know who we're talking to. And most of the time, we don't know people well enough to even sort that out. So that's the challenge I think I face, and I think you probably did too, Dave. So, hey, listen, I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
Excellent call as usual, Dave. Appreciate it. Back up there. Is it like really cold up there right now?
No, actually, it's about 50 degrees, and there's a little misty rain, but the Bears are out, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Wonderful. I get a chance to go up in November to do a small conference up there. I'm looking forward to seeing the country. So hopefully maybe I can touch base with you and meet with you when I get up there. Thanks so much for your call, Dave. I appreciate it. We're going to go to a break right now because we are getting close to our break, and I'm looking forward to talking to Greg at Brooklyn, New York when I get back. Right here, Stand to Reason.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Last month, I took 17 Christian high school students on the Muslim Mission. This is a four-day trip where they got to practice their skills in apologetics and evangelism. Find out what happened on this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Get it from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
And I woke up in love this morning. I woke up in love this morning. Went to sleep with you on my mind.
So is that Doug actually singing in that as well? Oh my gosh, I can't wait to talk to him. And how many guys do you know are doing apologetics who actually are singing on CDs? That's nuts. Okay, well, anyway, I digress. Let's get over to Greg in Brooklyn. And I think I've got you. Oops, I didn't lose him. Is Greg on one still or no? Greg,
Greg,
how are you? Thanks so much for being patient with us. You've been on hold a little while. Let's talk. What do you got going?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm calling from Brooklyn. I called into Greg's show a couple of weeks ago, basically with questions about Christianity. So I just wanted to follow up on that. And actually, a lot of my questions might be helpful. I heard you guys are talking about training apologetic students and so forth. So I think a lot of my questions might be questions that other people have about it.
Okay, great. Now, you called about the issue of who defines sin. Is that what your question is today?
Right. Who defines sin? And basically, the thing with that question is I need to take one step back before that and sort of say, okay, what is the Christian worldview? Particularly maybe the Protestant view is that, people go either to heaven or to hell after they die. And if Jesus paid for your sins. So if you accept Jesus in some way, in some specific way, then you go to heaven. But otherwise, you wind up in hell. And certainly there's a lot of, this is a simplification, and there's a lot of theology behind it. And last time, Greg did a great job of explaining, Paul's doctrine of original sin. But overall, I think, is that a fair summary to say that people either go to hell or heaven, if they accept Jesus, they go to heaven?
Well, I think I think my perspective on this, and of course everyone's got a different way of cashing this out, and this is how I would present it to you if you and I were talking across the table from each other. It's that I believe that there is a God that is powerful enough to have created everything from nothing. So let me just walk it through my few steps with you, okay? Maybe it'll help you see where I'm coming from, Greg. And I think that there's good reason to believe that we're in a universe that has a beginning, and that if there's a God that's powerful enough to create this universe as we see it today from nothing, life from non-life, matter from non-matter, it seems to me that this kind of being has incredibly tremendous power, unfathomable power. And if that's the case, it makes sense to me that a being of this nature would have the power to eliminate imperfection. And so if that's the case, this is a being of perfect nature. It's a perfect being. And so the question then becomes whether or not you and I, if we ever hoped to be united with a being like this, would we be able to do that given our imperfections? Would there be some way for us to be united with a perfect being given that we are by our very nature imperfect? Now, we can argue about why we're imperfect and all those things, but the point is I think you and I would both agree that we're imperfect. So the question becomes, Greg, I don't see it as a situation where God would be punishing you for not choosing Christ, but instead that God would simply be giving to us what we earned, what we deserve, unless, of course, we're willing to take a pardon. And the pardon is
correct. So basically the situation is, the Christian worldview is that without Christ, if one does not know about Jesus, then they simply have no chance because they are a sinner and they might not be aware of it, or they might not, not have atoned for it in the right way. And so they can't be with God because once they die, that's over. They can't take any more actions, and therefore they cannot accept Christ after they die.
Yes, I believe.
And therefore, right?
Yeah, I believe that they cannot accept Christ after they die. That this is the life in which we get this opportunity. It's in this life. Yes.
All right. Well, look. So that sets the foundation for my question. So my question is like this. First of all, there are lots of people in the Old Testament that are described as righteous, and there's no concept of this like sort of binary outcome of heaven or hell. If these righteous people, certainly they never knew about Jesus directly because they lived before him. And there's never indication that King David or Moses, had good things happen to them. And they were considered righteous and God loved them. And certainly these people did sin once in a while. So my first question would be, how do you reconcile theologically the fact that in the Old Testament people are described as having good things happen to them? Even though they didn't know about Jesus.
Well, I'm absolutely prepared to have that discussion with you, but Greg, but let me just say this, because I want some limitations of time. I'm seeing right now where we are in our time. You called about this idea of who defines sin, but I'm willing to go ahead and answer this question, but I'm not going to be able to do both. So if we run in this direction, I'm not, no problem doing that, but maybe you can call back then later on and talk to Greg about who defines sin. But if we're talking about how people were saved before Jesus, that's a different issue, and I'm more than willing to cover that with you, but I just want to make sure that you and I don't...
I understand. Okay, I'm going to... Let's actually focus on the question of who defines sin, because I think it's more relevant to everyone who desires to be saved. Because after all, perhaps they don't care how Chinese people who have never heard about Jesus, maybe the missionaries just didn't preach it that well, and they said one or two words about Jesus, and so these Chinese now have no chance of being saved. But regardless, let's say you've heard about Jesus, and now you're not under the law. So then the big question is, how do you decide, for example, that homosexuality is a sin because it's maybe in Leviticus, or maybe Paul speaks out against it? How do you decide that is a sin, but not, let's say, eating pork or working on the Sabbath day? I mean, don't Christians have different ideas about this? And
is your question, what is it? I just recently, for example, I'll just throw this out to you. Recently, Dan Savage was speaking in front of a high school group of journalists, high school journalists, and made a point of saying that, there's lots of, and maybe you heard about this, he's an anti-bullying advocate. He himself is homosexual, and he made the argument that, hey, there's lots of stuff that you silly Christians choose to ignore. Right. He chooses to ignore, but it seems like you kind of pick and choose between what it is you're willing to ignore and what it is you're not willing to ignore.
Right.
So, I'm not sure that really goes to the issue of who defines sin. Let me just answer that question for you today.
Sure.
And then if we don't go any farther than that, I'll give you a chance to call in and talk to Greg about this as well. But I think in terms of who defines sin, I think you and I'm trying to remember from your call last week, Greg, are you Jewish or are you a skeptic? Or what's your position?
I have a Jewish background. So essentially, let me just frame the question in a way that I think your answer would be most helpful, if that's okay, for 30 seconds. My question would be like this. Imagine you're a Jew in Jesus' time, in Israel. So you have the tradition of your fathers that God gave the law forever. And you have a personal, God has a personal relationship with your nation. You're part of that nation. And God specifically says the number one thing, do not have other gods. Do not stop following my law. And what my question is then you're approached by Paul or maybe some of the apostles. And these guys are former fishermen. Paul is a Pharisee and so forth. And they can do miracles maybe or some magic tricks or whatever it is. The question is, why would you then believe them just based on what they say? When your own tradition tells you to not believe prophets to try to take you away from the law, which does define what sin is. I don't see how sin is defined once the law is taken away, basically. I think it seems to be arbitrary to me. So that's my question. As a Jew, what is your Jewish supposed to do in Christianity? Are you still supposed to follow their law or no? I'm sorry if that's all over the place.
I'm gonna tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna put you on hold for a second. For some reason, in my headphones, your call is really, really kind of troubling and really high. I'm getting some feedback, so let me just put you on hold for a second. I'll try to respond to that. Okay.
Sure. Absolutely.
Thanks for being patient with me on that. I'm just trying to see if I can somehow avoid that feedback in my own headphones. Okay. So basically, I look at this and I say, okay, what is the issue here in terms of, are we saying, well, who defines sin? I think that both of us would agree. Well, if you were Jewish or you're a Christian, we would say it's the holy nature of God that is reflected in the moral code. It's not as though we say, hey, God creates a certain set of laws. And he could change those laws. Whatever he thought was offensive before, he could change those now. And it's kind of willy-nilly. It's just his opinion, and he kind of comes in, he could change the law. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that the actual moral code is a reflection of his holy nature. And we can sometimes see what is sin by assessing what is holy. And so we can look at this holy picture of who God is, and we're able to then say, we can determine what is the opposite of these things. And we know, and sometimes he's just flat out told us, you ought not do this, ought not do that. But if nothing else, when we know that God is of a certain nature, we can assess our own lives and compare ourselves to this holy God. And we can see any number of ways that we are not God, that we are not like God. So I think when it comes down to what it is that defines sin, we know we've got the special revelation of Scripture in which God tells us those things. But let me just throw a couple of concepts out to you, and this may not be satisfying to you. It may not. But one of the things that I was going to talk about a little bit in the second hour, but I was so much happier to talk to Alan about our trip, was this idea that was offered by Dan Savage, this idea that you Christians, you seem to obey certain laws and to see certain things are important. You don't ignore certain things, and you seem to ignore these other things. You're inconsistent about what it is in the Old Testament you'll embrace and what it is you'll ignore. And that's the kind of the claim that you say, look, you're all tight about this stuff with homosexuality, but you seem to ignore Leviticus 29, verse 9 about disobedient children. You seem to ignore Deuteronomy 22:13 about the daughters who are not virgins when they marry. I don't see you Christians stoning or trying to create laws in which you're going to stone children or stone daughters who aren't virgins. It seems like you Christians are just picking willy-nilly what it is you will embrace and what it is you will ignore. Now it's time for you Christians to ignore your uptightness about homosexuality the same way you ignore your uptightness about disobedient children. Well, let me just throw out to you that my response to that, which is I think there are some things that I absolutely choose to ignore, but it's not in a willy-nilly kind of a nature. It's not my random personal preference that causes me to ignore certain concepts or certain things in the Old Testament. I ignore all the penalty aspects, for example, of the Levitical law, because I know these were never intended to be universal, global, timeless penalties. So these are given specifically to the nation of Israel that God was calling out as a holy people of his own. I remember one time as a young kid doing something with my mom that I had just watched another kid in the store do, shoplift. And I remember reaching over to pick up that candy and do the exact same thing. And my mom, being a good Italian mom, slapped me in the face, said, put that back. And I was like, wait a minute, I just watched the other kid do it. But, you know, her statement to me is probably a statement you may have made to your own kids, or maybe have heard others make to their kids. That's okay. That kid belongs to somebody else. You belong to me. We don't, you know better. I taught you better than that. You don't do that. I thought, wow, what a high bar she has for me. Well, it turns out God has an equally high bar for his own people in the Old Testament. And while I would say there are certain penalties that I would give certain crimes here in California, they may not always line up with the penalties that were given to God's holy, called out, chosen people. Certainly God did not intend those for everyone living around the nation of Israel. It's because he knew his people knew better. You're mine. If you see them doing that, that's one thing, but you won't be doing that. Whereas I think at the same time, Greg, a certain number of things that I do accept and I choose to embrace. And it's not willy-nilly here either. It's not on some randomly based on some personal preference. I accept that the things that God says offended him in that law truly do offend him, even now. And so I don't look at, you know, well, gosh, he seems to be upset about kids who are disobedient the same way he's upset about homosexuality. So therefore, he's not that upset about homosexuality. No, I look at that and I say, it turns out he's as upset about disobedient children as he is about homosexuality. Now, while I would reject the actual penalty aspect of this, I know it's deeply offensive to God. It still is. Now, the penalty may be different in the culture in which I live, but I accept without kind of a random personal preference that these things are still offensive to God. But, of course, any laws that you might give an agricultural or a herding culture that deals with animals or deals with growing crops is going to be different in our time, right? I mean, we're going to have to take those basic principles and apply them to the information age in which we live. But I would say that I do not reject just randomly. I actually have a reasonable reason for rejecting certain things in the Old Testament and embracing others. And it's not based on some kind of willy-nilly personal preference. It's actually based on a very thoughtful, I hope, I intend it to be a thoughtful, consistent way of looking at the Old Testament. Now, what I'd like to do at some point, and I hope you'll call back and talk about the issue of what it is that how people were saved before Christ. But just so you can know, I think Greg and I may disagree a little bit on that issue. I believe that they did have a sufficient understanding of grace in the Old Testament. I think you look at Psalm 32, you'll see a beautiful, impassioned description of what grace is, and you can compare it to Romans 4. I think that ancient believers did expect a Messiah, and you would see this on Genesis 3. You can see it in Genesis 22. Romans 4 is another example of this description looking backwards of the expectation of a Messiah. And I think you can also see in Scripture that they had sufficient faith alone in the Messiah alone is what brings us into this is what saves us. And I think you can look at the Old Testament and in many ways see, in fact, that Old Testament saints did have a sufficient faith alone in the Messiah alone. And that is how I would kind of cash that. I've written an article on that, How Were People Saved Before Jesus? It's in the gospel section of PleaseConvinceMe.com. I'll try to get that on Twitter here in a few minutes. Hey, thanks so much for wrapping up the second hour here at Stand to Reason. And in the next hour, I'm looking forward to talking to the author of the bumper music we've been using, Doug Powell, about his book, Resurrection Eyewitness. Looking forward to that. Stay with us right here, Stand to Reason. Third hour at Stand to Reason. I'm Jay Warner Wallace. Looking forward to finishing up. We're still on, of course, American Family Radio Network. So glad you're here and joining us in this third hour. If you missed the first two, you know you can catch it again on podcast at str.org. There's no run I go on, I don't think, anymore when I'm not listening to Greg in my head. It's weird. I think if I hear Greg, I start to move and want to run because it's like one of those. Anyway, but I'm glad to be here with you, looking at the most important issues of life, ethics, values, and religion, and taking a stand for the things that matter most. And we get a chance to do that every week at Stand to Reason. And glad to be doing that for Greg this week, who's out of town. And I've got a chance on the phone now for this last hour together. And I'm really lucky because Melinda does a great job of setting me up with some of the greatest thinkers and contributors to apologetics and to Christian thinking. And I'm always humbled when I get a chance to interview these folks. And one of these today is Doug Powell, who's written and designed. And this is the important thing, is that this is an unusual project, because most of us who get an opportunity to write a book, that's great. And I've had a chance to do that now, too, and I really enjoyed it. But this is different, because this book called Resurrection Eyewitness was, yes, Doug wrote it. But more importantly, I think, is Doug designed it, and that's the kind of crazy and wonderful thing about your work. Doug, you on the line with me right now?
Yeah, how's it going?
It's so awesome to have you here. I just want to kind of make sure that I tell people about the book and really kind of explain it properly, because it's unlike other books. Basically, it came out. I'll ask you more about this, but it came out of your work on developing an iPad application. But it's wonderful in the sense that you've really had a chance to integrate so many different aspects of your life as a designer, as a Christian thinker, and this is a beautiful, truly, it's one of a kind work you've got called Resurrection Eyewitness. Thanks so much for joining me today here on Stand to Reason. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Hopefully you can hear me over the thunder. We're having a thunderstorm here in Nashville right now.
Are you really? Well, did you probably, it's a beautiful time of year. I know it heads into spring. My dad's in northeast Texas, about 8 hours from you, and I'm usually there in northeast Texas, and it's just a wonderful place. It's probably pretty green right now and stormy occasionally, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, let me introduce you properly to the people who are listening. Doug Powell is the author of the Holman Quick Source Guide to Christian Apologetics. And by the way, if you don't have that, that's actually a nice, quick resource that everyone needs to have on their shelf. I've got it on mine. And also, you're the creator of the Resurrection Eyewitness app. Now, you've got this book we're talking about today, which we're going to talk about in a minute, but you're also about to release two other products, the Jesus Eyewitness, both as a book and an application, and the New Testament Eyewitness app. And I think both of those are going to be offered on both the Apple and the Android platforms, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, and I'm not sure when the actual release dates are of those yet. Just depends on how productive I can remain. But I'm cranking away.
Now, you're also a recording artist and a composer, the art director at Apologia Educational Ministries. And I want to make sure before we get any further that we point people to your website. It's at www.selflessdefense.com. Do I have that correct?
Yes, that's for the stuff that I do in apologetics.
That's right. Now, I've had a chance to interview people here on the show that we talk a lot about trying to integrate our Christian worldview into all the other aspects of our life and all the other aspects of our culture, including the arts. But of all the people I've met who have tried to do that, it seems to me you've really done perhaps the best job of trying to integrate who you are as a designer and an artist into who you are as a Christian and an apologist. Tell us a little bit about what motivated you. And by the way, I just want to point people right now, if you own an iPad, the Resurrection the Eyewitness app is really, Doug, it's ridiculously cheap. I mean, this is worth twice what you're charging for it, and it's 99 cents right now if you go to the application store, the app store, and you download the Resurrection Eyewitness. Everyone needs to do it because it's just a tour de force in graphic presentation of the case for the resurrection. And so it's not the typical kind of written case. It's a beautifully visual graphic case for the resurrection. What gave you the idea to do such a thing?
When I first got into apologetics and was doing all my reading, that was just so fascinating for me. I found myself stopping pretty often to try to find pictures of the things that I was reading about. There's kind of a tactile element to apologetics, as far as I'm concerned, that I think is missing in most of the works that are out there. And so that's what that's how the Quick Source Guide came to be so illustrated. I mean, there's really nothing original about the Quick Source Guide other than it's a pretty lavishly illustrated overview of apologetics, a bunch of the main arguments and how they work together and stuff. And when I started teaching apologetics in Sunday school classes and doing talks on them, I'm a designer. I think visually, and so that's the way I did it. And it seems to really resonate with people. There are a number of things that are far easier to communicate visually and then support with talk rather than just trying to walk everybody through it just by listening to words, especially in this culture. So kind of the next step beyond that was what turned into Resurrection Eyewitness, which actually didn't start life as an app. It was a book. The book was completely done and laid out, and when the publisher decided they wanted to go for it, somebody said, you know, we could turn that into an app. You know, that's got app written all over it.
No, there's no doubt. No doubt about it, yeah.
Yeah, because it's a book that really acts like an app. So they decided to make an app of the book. And but they were able to turn that around much more quickly than it takes to go find a printer that can do this kind of interactive book. And so the app came out about a year ago, but it was kind of an ancillary product to the book.
Yeah, there's no doubt. When I first saw it, and I was talking to Melinda when I first came into the studio, and I want to ask you about your background too, but my background is in the arts as well. I have a bachelor's degree in design and then a master's degree in architecture. And when I looked at the application, I said, wow, I bet you this is a book first, because the way things move and open and unfold, it certainly seems like it's thinking it ahead of itself as to how can I produce this with paper on two dimensions down the road so I can make it three-dimensional. And so it was clear, but I mean, people have to see, when we say a book, I mean, what would you kind of compare this to in terms of, you know, when I was growing up, there were these open-up books that would have the pop-ups would come out, you know. It's not quite like that, but every page of your book is interactive in the sense that it's tactile. We get to move things around, open things up, unfold things, connect the dots basically by touching the actual pages and manipulating the pages to get to the information. And so in some ways, were you influenced by something prior to doing this, or did you just say, hey, you know what, I'm just going to kind of try to think out of the box?
Well, there were two things, and yes, I was trying to think out of the box as well, but as a designer, one of the people who's influenced me is a guy named Edwin Tufte, who is an expert on how to visually represent statistical information. And I went to a seminar of his, and he held up, I believe, the first edition of Galileo, where he opens up some different pages and shows how the book was completely interactive, you know, back in 15 or whatever, whenever the thing came out. But somebody had printed out little slips of paper and folded them in half and printed on them and glued them onto the page, every single book, because these interactions helped get his research across in a way that was more easily grasped. And I thought, oh, that's just the coolest thing I've ever seen. You know, I understand why people don't do it, because it's so expensive to do it. But isn't that cool that way back then people were thinking like that?
Oh, absolutely.
So I had that.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I've got a couple of kids,
yeah,
as well, who ran into these books, part of a series called the Ology series, mm-hmm. and they have the same sort of thing as this Galileo book, only they're more lavishly illustrated, but they're all fantasy themes. There's like pirateology and, you know, alienology and wizardology and stuff like that. And I'm sure that played into it as well. Just the idea that there was somebody out there making these kind of interactive books, that there was a market for it, because they kept making more. So this just but nobody had ever taken scholarly information and tried to present it in this format. And so you know, all of those kind of got thrown into a blender, and Resurrection Eyewitness came out.
Well, it's so funny you should mention Edward Tufte, because I too do a lot of work visually because of my background, and I do it all in cold case trials. And so I was sitting in, I think, a two-day seminar with Edward Tufte probably about – oh gosh, it might be 8 years ago now. And I think I remember this part of the presentation as well. He's somebody who's had high criticism for the use of PowerPoint. And I wanted to hear what he had to say about it because we're constantly trying to express these ideas visually, right? And I started doing that in trial, trying to bring in some of my background in design. But I wanted to see what this really a foremost expert on this issue of presenting statistical information visually had to say about it. So I think this is interesting that it also kind of directed your work here as well. But let me ask you, let's just go back and talk, tell people what it is your what's your educational background that kind of gave you this breadth of experience to draw from?
Well, I have a graphic design degree and a bachelor's in it, and that's how I've made my living when I wasn't making a living or trying to make a living from music. Mm-hmm. So I have a background as a recording artist whose day job was a graphic designer, or sometimes vice versa, a graphic designer whose day job was a musician. This just depended on, you know, the circumstances at the time. And then I fell in love with apologetics and decided, well, you know, I'm studying and reading this stuff so much, I might as well get credit for it. So I got a master's at Biola.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. What a great, unique set of, you know, we always talk about kind of a blooming where we're planted, right? This idea of trying to take the gifts that God has given us and the lane that we happen to be running in anyway, and how can we use the gifts that we have? And I think you've got an unusual set of gifts. And I sometimes find that people will say the same thing. I went through a similar experience. I spent 9 years in the arts before I went into law enforcement because my dad was a cop and it kind of drew me in. But I've never let go of my passion for creating. That's the thing that is so, it's a narcotic in a sense. Yeah, I feel like I'm drawn to trying to create something. Now, you also have done the same thing. Did you realize we've been playing your music as the bumper music for the show all day today? Did you know that?
No, but Melinda told me that, so I hope there are people who are still listening.
Yeah, they're still listening. Don't worry. It was great. I think people wanted to hear who is this guy who is an apologist who is also creating music. So I want to be able to talk to you about that in a minute. But before we get there, I want to be able to just talk, first of all, about the app that's available right now, the Eyewitness app for Apple. So, again, you can see that there's a certain foundation in the design of the book that appears in the app. But it's very, very beautiful. So you're telling me, Doug, that you're responsible for every illustration in both the app and the book? Is that how this worked? You actually laid it out visually first?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. When I showed it to the publisher, it was completely done.
That's awesome.
So, you know, we fixed some misspellings, but that was it. You know, the only trick was finding a printer who could do, you know, to make a book like that.
Yeah, it's a very large book. For those who are used to buying books online or whatever, this is a book that I would guess is probably, maybe a foot wide by 14 or 15 inches tall. It is very large. It's kind of a book that I had it on my desk for about 3 days. And of course, it didn't last long there. It moved immediately to the dining room table. And I have two high schoolers and one who's an adult kid living at home. He comes to visit me at home. And then I've got one son who's in college. So these four kids are very, I think in the age group I would most want to reach with the truth of the gospel, right? And they immediately they saw the book, and it's one of those books you have to open every page. You have to open every flap. You have to go through page after page. No one stops. It's that engaging. And then for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, I hope you have a tremendous success with this, because not just how beautiful the book is, and it certainly is that, but more importantly, the content of the book, I'll be talking about that in a minute, the approach you took in making the case for the resurrection. But just looking at the images themselves, you've incorporated a number of classic images of the Passion Week, of the resurrection. And so when you did that, I'm sure that you, like me, you probably went through a lot of art history classes, and you were probably somebody who was aware of what was out there. But how did you actually find the imagery for this book, aside from, of course, creating a lot of this imagery?
The things that I didn't create, I had to go find, and the one of the criteria was it had to be free or very inexpensive. I knew that this was going to be such an expensive book to print, that they that whatever publisher ended up with it was not going to have a whole lot of money to for an art budget. And so part of the attraction of bringing a book that was so expensive to do to the publisher was the fact that all the art was public domain. And so, I mean, right out of the gate, that cuts down, you know, a significant amount of art that's usable. But, you know, God's hand was on this, and I was able to find art that was print resolution and public domain, and that fit exactly what I was trying to illustrate. And so, that's really it.
That's always the trick too when we're doing presentation work, when we're trying to illustrate things to a group at a conference, is trying to find the print resolution stuff, the biggest, the highest quality stuff that's out there, that when we get it on the screen and it's 15 feet wide, that it actually still looks presentable. And the book is obviously beautiful, and I'm just wondering, you said that God's hand was in it, and I think sometimes as Christians, you know, we hear that a lot from our brothers and sisters. But what, in a tangible way, tell me how it is you sensed God's hand was in it, aside from maybe was it just because you were able to find these things, or did you really have some experience of God as a part of doing the book?
No, it is the prior. What I mean is that everything fell into place so easily, so quickly, and it's one of the things. It was, as a Christian, when you create something like write a song and then go back and listen to it later, sometimes you could just go, I don't even know how that song got written.
Yeah.
You know, there are insights in the lyrics that I didn't realize I had. I didn't know that's what I was writing when I wrote it, but I get it now, you know. And so, you know, you sense that something, you're being blessed by your own music, not in a vain way, but in a very surprising way that shows that sometimes reveals that, you know, much more was going on than you were aware as the agent of this piece of art. And that's true visually as well. And that's really all I mean by this. I mean, this is not something I slaved over. It might look like it, but I didn't. It was, you know, it's like when you hear Elton John say that he spends 10 minutes writing a song. He just sits down and if it doesn't come out in 10 minutes, it just doesn't happen, and he drops and he moves on to something else. Okay, this is a book like that. It just happened.
Yeah, and it doesn't look that way at all. It's visually stunning. And so I wanted to spend the first part of our conversation talking about the kind of graphic background before we moved to the issues related to the actual work of investigating the resurrection. But before I leave this section, let me just ask you this, Doug, a technical question that maybe only a few of us listening are going to even care about. What is that? Did you use Photoshop to do this work? What was the actual software you used to create this beautiful book?
Photoshop was used in all the spreads. Some of the things I had to create using a couple of different 3D programs. Poser actually was one of them, and then it all got laid out in InDesign.
Got it. Okay, now that I've lost, you know, a significant portion of our audience trying to figure out what the heck is Poser, what are these crazy things they're talking about, let's get back after the break and we'll talk about the actual approach, the minimal facts approach, which you illustrated in this, but I think it's very powerful. And as I get to present this across the country as well, I take a little bit different approach. I'm intrigued by a couple of the pages of your book, and I want to go into those as well. So we'll take a break right now, come back with Doug Powell, who has written a great asset to if you've got a collection of books that describes the resurrection and you're looking to have an illustration that is so visual and graphically rich that it's engaging and you can't put it down, this is the book for you, Resurrection Eyewitness. We'll be back with Doug Powell right here. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason.
Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that we are all ambassadors for Christ. This verse has guided STR's mission from the beginning, helping you and other Christians to grow as ambassadors for Christ. And it's why we created a new series of booklets called The Ambassador's Guide. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. Our newest release in this timely series is on the subject of Islam. Written by STR speaker Alan Schliemann, this booklet is a vital resource to prepare you with the knowledge and wisdom to better understand the Muslim faith while sharing Christ in an effective manner. A skill that will be especially valuable in the changing world at our doorsteps. Other topics in the series include the New Atheists and Postmodernism, with other subjects coming out this year. To order your copy of The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, or any title in the Ambassador's Guide series, call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or order online at str.org.
What kind of faith are you passing on to your young people? Is it blind and irrational, or is it reasonable? This is Brett Kunkel, and in this month's Bulletproof Podcast, I'll discuss the biblical view of faith young believers need to hear from us. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad. Available for free from iTunes or the Android market, you can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
It must be weird for your guest to sit and recognize his own music in the bumper. We are just such a, this is a basically a big self-serving commercial for Mr. Doug Powell, isn't it? That's okay. I think it's good that we're doing that for you because I think it's worth it for this book. I want to say one last thing before we move away from kind of the graphic aspect of the book. You know, we're looking at it and we're thinking, how can this stay this cheap? I mean, the price of the book is really very reasonable for what it is. I don't know how it must be a part of the production process. Or do you know, did you worry that this is going to be, it's a great idea, but it's going to be really expensive to produce?
Oh, yeah, that was always the worry. And that was the very first thing anybody in the publishing world thought was, yeah, cool book. How in the world are you going to get it made? You know, that's way too expensive. But we were able to do some, you know, hunting around. It's a global economy now. So we plugged in with a couple of different printers in China, and this is, it turns out they have no problem making this book. And so, you know, it just became a matter of them saying, the publisher thinking they could sell enough books in a certain amount of time to justify ordering a certain amount of quantity, and that gets it low enough to get that price point.
Yeah, I wonder how long it'll be before we actually see this book in other languages as well. You know, I'm thinking to myself, hey, the people who are making this book are probably so drawn to the content because of the nature of the tactile and visual aspect of the book. But I wonder, they probably can't read the English, but it won't be long before you're going to be asked to do this in many other languages, do you think?
There was already a little bit of murmuring about that, so we'll see.
Yeah, I think what's so great about this, a visual approach to discussing things that are apologetic, is that it engages you quickly without the barrier of language. And then, you know, if the language is supportive, you can do all kinds of crazy things. I would imagine if I was looking at this book and I didn't speak English, I would, on the basis of the graphic content, want to know, what does that say? You know, what do those set of words say when I open up this folder, the piece of paper? You know, and I think it won't be long before you're going to be asked to do it in other languages. So,
that's kind of the cool thing about this form is that people will engage the book just because of those interactions and because of the kind of the immersive graphic nature of it, whether they care about arguments for the resurrection or not. They just want to fool with the book. And, you know, so that's kind of the spoonful of sugar.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I'm going to be referring now. I've got my iPad open, and I'm looking at the application on iPad. I'm going to be looking at this as I talk to you because you've taken an approach, and this is one last question. Why did you, of all the kinds of work you might begin with this graphic approach, and you just know that this is probably going to be a signature type of work that you're going to probably end up looking at lots of other issues in this graphic manner. Why did you decide to start with the resurrection?
Well, it being the central claim of Christianity, that unique claim that Paul makes in uh, that that I quoted the first book in 1 Corinthians 15:12-19, that
right.
if you want to prove Christianity is false, then come up with a better story for what happened to Jesus, 3 days after he was executed and buried. So he points that out as kind of the defeater. You knock that down, you knock everything down. So that seemed like a sensible place to start. And I just had always, had so many different visual things come to mind as I walked people through this particular argument, that it was an easy start point for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's interesting, too, as we look at the way you began the book. You start off with, now, the great thing about this book, too, is that we can talk about it page by page if we want to, and there's no, like, giveaway. There's no, what's the word I'm looking for when you give away the plot line of a
spoiler?
No spoilers. Right. Thank you. Then you're helping me out.
Yeah.
At 51,
yeah, Christianity survives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly. We know what our conclusions are, but more importantly, we can talk about the detail of how you approach it, because there's so much more to the richness, the visual richness of the book, that if I gave you every word of this book, it wouldn't matter. You still got to go get it, because you got to play with it. You got to see how it works. Anyway, but you started off with an approach that's been made most popular probably by Gary Habermas and Mike Lycona, this idea of the minimal facts approach. There are certain minimal facts that even the most liberal scholarship would kind of grant us, and then we've got to find what is the best explanation. This is something that I travel in a lot because, Doug, I do a lot of cold cases in which we do the exact same thing. We're looking at the facts in the room, the pieces of evidence. We look at possible explanations, and we do that process of abductive reasoning. What makes the most sense of the possible explanations, which one of these is the most reasonable given the evidence in the room? And that's kind of your approach here as well, right?
Right.
Now, okay, so you started, though, I thought it was interesting. You kind of back up a step with the predictions of Jesus' death. Why did you kind of back up before just launching into the minimal facts?
Because I wanted to show what the minimal facts are going to buy you. Okay, you got to set the context here. And the reason I started with the predictions Jesus made about his death is because Jesus made a lot of kind of claims that can't be fact checked. Okay, way out there kinds of claims, and we have to have some kind of reason, some way of believing that Jesus is telling us the truth about things that we couldn't investigate, that we couldn't fact check. So if we look at the claims that he made about his death, and there are a number of them, the time of death, that he'd be betrayed, who would do it, where, when, and most astonishingly or outlandishly, that he would rise again on the third day. Okay, if those all come true, particularly the raising again on the third day, if all of those happen, then you've got good reason to trust Jesus for the things that you can't go and investigate like that. And these have to do with it really gets you everything, because it gives you the authority of Jesus to talk about the Old Testament, for example, as Scripture. You know, the reason why we accept that as Scripture is because Jesus did. Why do you trust Jesus? Because of the resurrection. Okay, it gets you everything. And that probably plays into why Paul is saying, you knock down the resurrection, you knock down this whole project, all of Christianity. And so, I don't want to just get to resurrection. I want to get to justification for interpreting the resurrection in a certain way. And that's how Jesus represented it. And that's why the end of the book, not only is not just, okay, the resurrection explains all these minimal facts. It justifies, because it accounts for all these facts and nothing else does, it justifies Jesus' own claims about himself and our interpretation of them in the historic Orthodox Christian sense as being correct.
That's awesome. That's a step that sometimes when I for example, have never taken that step when I presented this material, and I think it's an important step. You've really kind of established what it is you're going to close with by opening as part of your opening statement. It's kind of like when we go to a jury, we make an opening statement, we show all the evidence, and at some point we have a closing argument. And you're actually doing something in your opening statement here that is you're going to use and make your case at the part of the closing argument. So that's foundational. But let's go through some of the typically when this approach is used, the minimal facts approach, what we do is we kind of look and we say, hey, what are the bare minimal facts that we think 90% or 85%, whatever it may be, of the scholarship, be it very liberal scholarship, be it maybe even skeptical scholarship, all the way to the traditional conservative scholarship on the issue would accept as things, points we would agree on when it comes to, now of course, you know, you and I understand this, but just for those who are listening who maybe haven't heard this approach before, we're going to begin with the set of evidences in the room that almost everybody agrees with. Now, what did you kind of decide to use as your commonly accepted set of minimal facts and minimal pieces of evidence?
Well, I believe Habermas actually has a list of 12,
yes.
But I took his approach of cutting it down even further just to show how strong the case for Christianity is, that we don't even need all 12 of those to make this case.
Right.
We do it with half that. And so I use 6. People kind of divide these facts in different ways. I think the way Habermas presents it, there's a couple he breaks out that I kind of conflate and vice versa. But I'm using 6 facts, that Jesus was crucified, that he died when he was crucified, that the tomb was found, that he was buried, and that the tomb was found empty, and that friends believed they saw Jesus after his death, and they believe they encountered the risen Jesus, and that there were enemies who believed they encountered the risen Jesus. And there I conflate Paul and James into that. I know that Habermas breaks them out into 2 separate facts. So,
right. Yeah, what's good about the way you did it too, Doug, is you separate them into 3 chapters, more or less, or pages, or of the application, 3 screens, in which you identify them in pairs of 2. You know, you have a page that's crucified, kind of in the category of crucified and died, in the category of the empty tomb, and in the category of friends and enemies. And in those 3 pages or screens, you've identified 2 minimal facts each. And I agree with that approach of taking an even shorter list than Gary might offer to say, hey, this really in and of itself doesn't prove anything. These are just the minimal facts in the room. Now we've got to have an explanation. And to say that the enemies and friends of Jesus claimed to see him risen does not mean he in fact was risen. There might be some explanation for that. These are just the minimal facts, right?
That's right. The goal is to state the facts as kind of as neutrally or unspun or uninterpreted as possible, in a way that all scholars or virtually all scholars are going to agree with. So if you say, you know, it's particularly important when you say Jesus's friends believe they saw Jesus. They may not have. Okay, we're not saying that claim. That we're just saying that they believed they did. Now, what are you going to do with that? Because almost all scholars agree with that one.
Right, exactly. So then the question becomes, and this is where I think abduction becomes very powerful, as we offer, and I thought I had a pretty complete set of offers for how we might explain this, the possible explanations for these 6 minimal facts. And when I present this work to groups, I think I present 6 or 7 alternative theories. But there were a couple here in yours that I really liked better than the way I present them. I hate to say that, but I do. They're actually better. As a matter of fact, you have, I think 8 or 7 before you even get to the Christian claim of the resurrection itself. You give 7 alternative theories. I think I only usually do 6. So yeah, you're a better man than me. So this is talk about is kind of the alternative theories that you've offered and said, hey, it may not be that he's resurrected. It may be that this is what actually happened. Let's take a look at maybe a more naturalistic explanation. And it's true that all the explanations that are offered, that anyone would offer to the 6 minimal facts, aside from the Christian claim of the resurrection itself, these are all explanations that could be they're completely philosophically natural. There's no supernatural element to any of these other 7 descriptions. Would you? That's I think the thing they all share in common. Correct?
That's at their best. Now, some of the implications of what their explanations are would actually require something just as astounding as a miracle to make it happen. And so they end up getting bit by that anyway. But yes, at their very best, they're all naturalistic.
Now, I don't want to go through in incredible depth on each one of these, because that would be, I think, the book does a better job than we could probably do on the radio. But you have covered some of the theories that classic apologists, like even Josh McDowell, has done a good job of kind of categorizing, what are the theories that we might offer to explain this. And, of course, one of the first one you cover is the swoon theory, this idea that Jesus really, was crucified but didn't die. And so what's great about your app in the book, too, is that you offer the theory, and then right away on the actual page where you offer the theory, you offer a kind of what you call a minimal facts checklist. Let's see what the theory describes here. And you have a little checkbox. Yes, he's crucified, but no, he didn't die. Yes, he's buried in a tomb, and yes, the tomb is found empty, and yes, the friends saw Jesus. But you left off here that enemies didn't see Jesus. Just explain to me how you kind of work through the swoon theory as an explanation for the resurrection.
Well, the swoon theory is pretty much answered a couple pages earlier, and when I describe why Jesus's crucifixion would have ties into his death, because once you understand what crucifixion is, how it what happens to your body, that it's you die every time. That was the job of the professional executioner to make sure it's seen all the way through. And you add that, the spear through the chest and into the heart cavity, and then you add to that the scourging, which some ancient sources call the first death, because it was very possible to die just from the scourging. Then you get all the I have a little medical clipboard on that page. It goes through the kind of just what is entailed in crucifixion. By the time you understand all of that stuff, the idea that Jesus would have survived and is kind of out the window. But even if he did, you end up with this absurd scene on Easter Sunday, because what I do is I put a map of ancient Jerusalem in the book, and if you unfold it, I've kind of drawn out all the things that Jesus had on his on his itinerary that day that
exactly.
He did after he rose, and he'd have to pop his arms back into place because they'd been dislocated, and his hands don't really work, and his ankles probably don't really work from the nerve damage, and he doesn't have any clothes on, and he's got strips of flesh hanging from his back from the scourging. He's got blood loss, and yet he pushes back, this several hundred pound stone, walks 7 miles to Emmaus, has a bite to eat, walks back 7 miles to Jerusalem, walks through the very city that watched him crucified a couple days earlier and would have recognized him. And yet he's walking through, he probably looks like some kind of zombie or something, because just the state of his body after that kind of torture. But nobody notices him, apparently. And then he has to find where the disciples are hiding, break into the room without them noticing, and present himself as if nothing's wrong.
Right.
Okay,
I mean, that map you have, Doug, is brilliant. I mean, that is such a visual. I mean, because that's exactly what is needed. You have to see where it is that Jesus reportedly goes afterwards, and imagine him doing this after he's just recovered somehow, or however briefly he can do it, from this massive beating he's just suffered. Yeah, it's a great idea.
Yeah. So the absurdity defeats it right there. So that's how I go after swoon.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. Now, the next one you talk about is the wrong tomb theory. Now, this is the one that I typically don't include when I do this presentation. And so I was interested in this. This is the idea that, hey, it's the reason why Jesus' followers found the tomb empty is because everyone simply went to the wrong tomb. So let's talk about that one a little bit and why that falls apart.
Well, one of the persistent problems with these opposing theories for what happened to Jesus is really the question of where's the body. Okay, so if everybody went to the wrong tomb, where's the body? In the right tomb. Well, the Romans know where the right tomb is. The Jews seem to know where the right tomb is. If Christianity is causing so much trouble even after Jesus' death, I got to open. do is go to the right tomb and open it up, and there's Jesus' body, and Christianity is dead. But nobody does that. You know, it just it doesn't make sense of that. It also doesn't explain why Jesus' followers were convinced they saw him after his death. It doesn't explain Paul's conversion. It doesn't explain James's conversion. So you don't have the enemies thinking they saw Jesus. And those are the two minimal facts it fails on. Are those the friends and enemies believe they saw Jesus? But there's again there's some practical things that kind of turn that work against it in terms of the different kinds of tombs that there are and what's described in the Bible is probably a less common type of tomb. It would be far less likely to be able to mistake it for some other kind of, the cocum, where it looks like a pizza oven type of thing. It would be a different kind of thing than that. So, given the relative uncommonness of that kind of a tomb, it's even less likely that they would mistake it anyway.
Yeah, great point. Okay, let's take a quick break here because we're up against the break right now. And when we come back, we'll just describe a few more of these alternate theories that have been offered. And then I want to ask you a little bit about your music as well. So let's take a break right now. I'm talking to Doug Powell, who is the author of Resurrection Eyewitness, the book, which is actually also offered now, as it has been for about a year, as an app on iPad. More with him after the break here on Stand to Reason.
In the United States, over 51 million abortions have been performed since it was legalized in 1973. That's one abortion every 26 seconds. If you have been wanting to be able to speak out effectively against abortion, or just be better prepared to discuss this often heated and always emotional topic, STR has a great resource to help equip you to do that. Stand to Reason Interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, prepares you for any pro-life encounter, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with the confidence that your case is solid, your knowledge deep, and your argument just. Created to be used as a personal study or in a small group setting in your church or home, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned, plug-and-play course provides the basic training for anyone to become proficient in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through video, workbooks, role-playing, and quizzes, Making Abortion Unthinkable will prepare you to restore meaning to the word abortion using compelling visual aids, simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, present scientific evidence to offer a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric, clear the red herring objections, and stay on course. Be respectful toward the person you're talking with. If you haven't yet taken a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at str.org.
Last month, I took 17 Christian high school students on the Muslim mission. This is a four-day trip where they got to practice their skills in apologetics and evangelism. Find out what happened on this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Get it from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
All right, back here with Doug Powell on Stand to Reason, talking about the Resurrection Eyewitness book and application, and really now kind of moving from the graphic nature of the book and how beautiful it is to the kind of sensible and rational content of the book and how powerful that is. And we're talking about the approach of minimal facts and looking at the evidence about the resurrection and saying, what's the least we can agree on? And then once we've got those six things listed, what are the possible explanations? We talked about how a swoon theory, in which Jesus is beaten badly but doesn't die might explain why he rises again. We've talked about how a wrong tomb might be the reason why the body was never found in a tomb, and why those are both deficient explanations. Let's move on, though, Doug, to the idea of the fact that the body might be stolen altogether, and this might explain why the tomb is empty. Let's talk about why that kind of lacks rational power.
Well, the stolen body, it just doesn't explain the behavior of the disciples particularly well, or really at all. It's not going to be the Romans who stole the body. It's not going to be the Jews who stole the body, because they both had reason to know where the body was in order to prove Christianity was false. Okay, if they wanted to kill Christianity and they'd stolen the body, all they got to do is go get the body from wherever they moved it to and produce it, and then Christianity's dead. So it takes pretty quick to the disciples stole the body, but that doesn't explain two of the minimal facts, which is that enemies believe they saw Jesus after his death, and that friends of Jesus believe they saw him after his death. Part of why that doesn't explain the disciples is because what the disciples did after they would have stolen the body, which was spread all over the world,
right,
to tell people about the risen Jesus, which would have been a lie. And not only that, but every one of them except for John was martyred according to tradition. The tradition we have doesn't let anybody off with old age except for John. There may be competing traditions that have a different location or a different time or a different way of their martyrdom, but it's unanimous that all these guys went to their death for proclaiming the risen Christ. And that's just, people certainly die for lies, but they don't die for things they made up, especially because the way in which these guys died it was very often kind of a long, torturous type of thing, gave them plenty of time to recant or, come clean and just say, we weren't trying to create some kind of conspiracy or do anything wrong. We were just trying to, honor the name of Jesus, and this just kind of got out of hand. And we're talking about over a period of 30, 35 years, and nobody came clean. Conspiracies just don't work like that, and people don't lie for things, die for things that they make up like that. And not only that, it didn't even give them, there was no motive for it. They didn't become wealthy. They didn't become famous, as if that was something valuable in that time anyway. At best, they became infamous. But, all they gave them was hardship and prison and beating and persecution and ultimately death. So there's no motive whatsoever for stealing the body.
Yeah, that's one of those areas that I like to talk about as well, because I've worked a lot of conspiracies on homicides where I've tried to do my best to break the conspiracy, and I've kind of learned what elements of conspiracy theory are important in order for a conspiracy to be successful. And I think you've captured a lot of those here. I want to ask you a strategic question, though. I noticed there's a certain order in which you present the alternate theories. And I typically will present the conspiracy theory first, the idea that the disciples are lying about significant facts first, because it seems that a lot of the other theories eventually devolve into a form of conspiracy, like the stolen body, for example. In order for this explanation to work, the apostles have to be lying. And so if we can deal with that issue first, then when we come back to it again in all the other theories, we can point back to our first discussion and say, well, and now we're back down to a conspiracy theory, and we've already talked about that, and here's why that is work. Was there a strategic reason why you didn't start with that one?
Not at all. In fact, until you just asked that question, I never considered it. I don't know why they're in the order they're in. I put the martyrs map. I got this two-page spread of where all the martyrs died and how they died. I put that in between stolen body and the conspiracy theory, where the disciples would have intentionally made up the story. There's a slight distinction I make between those two things, but the argument against them is almost exactly the same. And so since they have this shared, powerful argument of the behavior of the disciples. I put the martyr's map in between them. I also refer to it in the legend theory that says that this just developed organically over time, like Elvis stories or something. That refers to it too. But I did stick the twin theory towards the end because that was probably the one I get the least. But other than that, I didn't really give any thought to it. Sorry. I wish I had a better answer for you.
No, that's great. Let's talk about that legend, the version two of the legend theory, this development idea. This is an idea that basically that years after Jesus' death, that stories about him kind of developed and evolved over time. Now, this is we may not get to many more of these alternate theories, but I want to at least discuss this one. Why do you think that falls? This is a common – we hear this a lot in the work of many modern skeptics who are writing about these gospels and why this is, they might believe that Jesus lived, but the way he's being characterized is a slowly evolving tradition or a legend. Why is this not sufficient as an explanation?
Well, it only accounts for three of the minimal facts. Again, it doesn't account for why the friends of Jesus believe they saw him risen after his death or the enemies, but it also is plagued by that constant question, where's the body? Okay, the body's still going to be in the tomb on a legend theory where it just kind of organically grows and gets out of hand. And, people who advocate this usually describe it as the development between the Jesus of history and the Christ of Christianity, okay, as if our view of Christ wasn't what people Jesus's followers believed at the time of his death. So wouldn't it be great if you had a document that actually did enumerate what people believed very soon after his death, maybe within a year or so? And the way this is most powerfully answered, I think, is by talking about the document we do have that is that does list what the earliest believers believed, and how it shows a very high view of Christ, and that comes from a creed that's embedded in 1 Corinthians 15:3-7. So I do a whole spread on that where I spend some time where I go through the timeline of Paul, how we date Paul, and how we date Paul's conversion, and how the creed that he's embedded in 1 Corinthians 15:3-7 predates his conversion. Now, his conversion is going to be anywhere between 1 and 5 years after the crucifixion, and he's using these kind of technical terms that's used to describe a tradition being handed down, something that he had received, and then he lists what he received, that Christ died for our sins according to scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to scriptures, and then he lists a bunch of witnesses as well. Now, because of the form that takes, most scholars believe this is a creed, and because it predates Paul's own conversion, now we're looking at, as early as within 1 year of the crucifixion. Now, because what that does is it shows there is no development in terms of this high view of Jesus, that he was the promised Messiah, that he was God incarnate, that he did die for our sins, that he is the fulfillment of all the prophecies and types that we see in the Old Testament, and that's one of the most easily and soundly defeated of any of the theories, in my view. And that's what's so weird is that it's probably the most popular one out there right now.
No, I thought it was a wonderful, and one of the dangers of your book, I'll just say it up front. One of the dangers of this book is that it's so beautifully graphically composed that people won't take the time to read every single word, because so much of what you got here, like this page on the oldest creed in 1 Corinthians 15:3-7, there's a lot of stuff that people need to – I mean, just that one timeline of Paul is very rich. It's what you just spent time talking about. And I just hope that people will open the book and every little nugget, they'll take the time to think about it. It's not a book you want to rush through. It still has got lots of great information. You want to spend the time to think, what does this timeline of Paul really tell us about how early this high Christology of Jesus begins? And it does begin very early, and others have written about this, and what you've done has made it beautifully visual and quick, brief. It can be be consumed quickly. But I want people to take the time to really understand and go through it in a deep way. Now, listen, Doug, we're going to run out of time here, so we're not going to. I want to take a little quick shift in gears if I can. I want to talk about your music for a second. Are you still recording music? Are you still active as a musician?
Yes, I had a record come out last year, although I don't have anything in the works right now because I'm so busy with the next couple of books.
Understood. But, now, when you're doing music, tell me how it is you're incorporating your Christian worldview in your creation of music. If you can do it to me, and you got a really short period of time here, but I want people to hear what you're doing. I know it's a lot to ask, but try.
Well, I mean, as a Christian, all artists incorporate the worldview into whatever they create, regardless of whether it's intentional or not. I am a Christian. What I do does incorporate a Christian worldview. I try to be self-conscious about it, but I try to do it in a way that's not indicative of, like, a contemporary Christian type of approach. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
No, that is helpful. Now, someone was telling me that from a theological perspective, you're actually writing music that kind of mines out your theological positions, aren't you?
Yes.
And that's, I think, that's, and that, I know that's impossible to try to describe, but that's the thing that we talk about in terms of redeeming our culture, redeeming music, redeeming the arts. You've done a wonderful job of doing that with the book. Clearly, this is an amazing, and I can only see that in the future you'll probably be doing this many times with many other concepts that are typically examined by what apologists would spend time writing words about. You're going to have the ability to do imagery to support the case, and I think that contribution alone is just amazing in apologetics and Christian. So I want to congratulate you on the book, on the app, and I can only imagine you're going to have a number of other projects ahead of you. So, Doug, thanks so much for joining me here on Stand to Reason. I appreciate taking the time with you, and I can't wait to meet you in person.
Well, thanks for having me. I'll see you in Phoenix.
Okay, that's right. That's right. We're in Phoenix, and it's about a month. I forgot all about that. Thank you for reminding me at Smart Faith Conference. I'm looking forward to meeting you there. Awesome. Okay, thanks so much, Doug. Well, that's
all
it for
right.
this. You're more than welcome. As if this week here at Stand to Reason, I want to give you some homework. You know how Greg typically does that? I want to give you some homework, too. Greg's written an article on faith and works, Paul versus James. It's on the website. That's str.org. And it's one of the thorniest textual problems that any Christian can face, but it actually has a very simple solution, and I wanted to encourage you this week for your homework to get over to str.org and read the article Faith and Works, Paul versus James. Thanks so much to Melinda and Barbara for doing a great job at making me look somewhat good here in the studio, and thanks to Greg for letting me sit in his chair. Had a great time talking to you this week. I'll see you back here actually in 2 weeks when I substitute for Greg one more time.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcast and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.